Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I was thinking last night about this case and their theory and how it didn't make any sense and how it didn't fit and how something is wrong. And it occurred to me how they were going to come here and stand up here and tell you how O.J. Simpson was going to disguise himself. He was going to put on a knit cap and some dark clothes, and he was going to get in his white Bronco and this recognizable person and go over and kill his wife. That's what they want you to believe. That's how silly their argument is. And I said to myself, maybe I can demonstrate this graphically. Let me show you something. This is a knit cap. I'm going to put this knit cap on. And you've been seeing me for a year. If I put this knit cap on, who am I? I'm still Johnny Cochran with a knit cap. And if you look at O.J. Simpson over there, and he has a rather large head, O.J. Simpson in a knit cap from two blocks away is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. And I ask you rhetorically this question. Who would know O.J. Simpson better? His mother Eunice? His sister Shirley? His sister Carmelita? His daughter Arnell? Or Marsha Clark and Chris Darden? Who do you think knows him when they stand up here and talk about his public persona and he's got this dark side? Those are all just words. He's a human being and he's not perfect. He's not proud of some of the things he did. But they don't add up to murder. There's no escalation of force and violence throughout 1989. It's not there. We don't have to call Lenore Walker. Your common sense tells you this. And then he goes into this kind of make-believe fantasy world where he's going to try to tell you on June 12th, he's going to conjure up this rage. June 12th. Very interesting day, isn't it? It's wonderful that we live in the age of videotape. Because he tells you about how O.J. Simpson was. Cindy Garvey was telling you how O.J. Simpson was. He was going to be this mean, dark, brooding person at this concert. That he was going to kill his ex-wife because he didn't like his seats. I guess that was what it was about, that he didn't like his seats or because he didn't invite her to dinner. And can you imagine that? That's how silly what they're talking about is in this case as he tries to play out this drama. But let me show you, rather than talk, a picture is worth 1,000 words. So let me show you this video. You watch this video for a moment, and we'll talk about it. This is for Chris Darden. Now, you'll recognize some of the people in this photograph after a while. There's Mrs. Simpson kissing Denise Brown, kissing Miss Juditha Brown. It's Mr. Lewis Brown. He's talking to a friend. That's his son, Justin, whom he kisses. He's smiling and happily waving. Mr. Brown's happy. Laughing, falling down, laughing again, bending over laughing. Now, you see that. You see that with your own eyes. You'll have that back in that jury room. How does that comport with this tortured, twisted reasoning that he was angry in some kind of a jealous rage? He's in a jealous rage like that to you? Your eyes aren't lying to you when you see that. Thank heaven we have videotape. I didn't tell you about that in opening statement. You think that's pretty compelling? Thank heaven we have that. And we know in this city how important videotapes can be when people don't want to believe things, even when they see it on videotapes. And you saw that yourself. So when you're back there, somebody tries to tell you there was some kind of jealous rage on June 12th, look at O.J. Simpson interacting with the Brown family and everyone else. Doesn't fit, doesn't make any sense. This man was upset. And you're going to see that everything he did from that moment that he found out that his ex-wife had been killed was consistent only with innocence. Absolutely that day. And so Arnell Simpson helps us in that regard. She's followed to the stand by Carmelita Durio. Sister, loves her brother, but you knew that. She was called to talk about Ron Shipp, one of the witnesses in this case that the prosecution called. It's interesting, isn't it, that neither one of the prosecutors wanted to talk about this dream, because I think they're embarrassed by this. They didn't talk about it. They should be embarrassed. A dream. They elicited evidence about some dream. Was it a daydream? Was it a night dream? Was it a nightmare? Was he looking out the window? What did it mean? Even the judge, his instruction. You can totally disregard that. If you got to figure out, I mean, who knows what that means? It probably didn't mean anything, because Shipp did not tell you the truth. If you listen to Carmelita, if you listen to Shirley, if you listen to Miss Eunice Simpson, Shipp was never alone with O.J. Simpson that night. He was an O.J. wannabe, bringing police officers over there, still wanting to be a police officer, off the force for whatever reason, drinking that night, drinking in the past as he said he was. He's not credible, and the evidence he brings is so unreliable, it's so irrelevant, that I don't want to spend much of your time with it. But you saw it, you heard them. I ask you to consider Carmelita, Shirley, and Eunice as against Ron Shipp, and you, I ask you, who you going to believe? I think it'll be no contest. Everything this man does is consistent with innocence. He finds out. He gets the first thing smoking. He comes back here. He goes right to his residence. He talks to the police. He goes downtown with the police. He goes in a room with the police. He has his finger photographed. He gives blood. His lawyers are off someplace else. That's what this man did on June 13th. They weren't there then. That's what he did. Consistent with innocence. They want to talk about luggage. The testimony, again, of this honest police officer, Thompson, is that they wouldn't let O.J. Simpson's luggage on the premises. They talk about Bob Kardashian. They smear Bob Kardashian, a good and successful, decent businessman and friend. He can't come on the premises. They have to take the luggage away. Now, these people have search warrants. They can do whatever they want to do at that point. They have the power of the state. And they have the audacity to stand here and tell you that when retired Judge Delbert Wong brings in the Louis Vuitton bag months and months and months later, there's no clothes in it. Now, is that folly? They're not supposed to unpack it? That is silly. I shouldn't waste my time on it. But that's what was said here. You heard it. And they are the ones who turned away the luggage. So you remember that when they stand up here and try to talk to you about any luggage and they didn't have it, or what was in the luggage, or what was it? He brought the luggage back. And if he didn't have, by the way, that portable phone in his luggage, you'd hear about that also. Understand, we're going to talk about the facts. So Van Adder, the man who carries the blood, starts lying in this case from the very, very beginning, trying to cover up for this rush to judgment. Those are words. That's rhetoric. Let me prove it for you. He tells us, and this is a board. The board's entitled Van Adder's Big Lies, the man who carried the blood. He tells us that O.J. Simpson is not a suspect. Now, that's the biggest lie we've heard probably in this entire trial. O.J. Simpson is not a suspect. They handcuff him within 30 to 45 seconds of the time he gets back here. He lies about that. Weitzman succeeds in getting him unhandcuffed, and they take him downtown. But he does more than that. Not only does he lie about that at the beginning, he then feels comfortable enough to talk to these two brothers, the Fiato brothers, and an FBI agent named Wax. And isn't this bizarre that the lead detective in this case, put on here because of his experience, is talking with these two guys who've been in this witness program for quite a while, testifying for the government. Now, we know that in a rather unusual set of circumstances, they're in a room somewhere in some hotel, drinking beer. It's not even Van Adder's case. And they're sitting around talking. And I asked the FBI agent, weren't you a little surprised that a detective would be talking to these two people about the Simpson case? Well, we found out that there was a relationship, allegedly, between Denise Brown and one of these brothers, and maybe he felt comfortable. But why would he do that? And what does he say? He tells them that we didn't go up there to save any lives. O.J. Simpson was a suspect. The husband is always the suspect. But then he comes into court here. This lead detective takes the stand again and lies to you under oath. Says, oh, well, no, I never said that. Never said that. That'd be a mistake if they said that. I never made that statement. He lied. He lied from the very beginning. He lied when they went over there. Then they bring in Commander Bushy, an otherwise good man. They get him involved in this. Let me tell you something interesting about what you heard about Phillips's voice. Phillips was talking to the coroner's office about 7, 8 o'clock in the morning on June 13th. The man asked him to identify, well, yes, we have one male female, one white female, one white male, as though he didn't know the names or whatever. Now, this is 5.5 hours after Bushy said, go over and notify O.J. Simpson, who's not even the next of kin, because we don't want the family to find out about this like they did in the Belushi case. Remember he said that? Now, he's doing all this from his house, from his home. Phillips, if you look through his testimony, look back through your notes as to when he says he knows who this person is. But isn't it amazing that the children are already down at the station? They're at her house. They got a phone with a speed dialer. They know. Bushy knows. They don't follow his orders out. They stand out in the street. Not investigating. Stand out in the street. Planning, doing whatever they're going to do. But one thing they do, they decide that O.J. Simpson is a suspect in this case. And let me tell you why you're going to know that. They want to talk a lot about 1985, but he missed the whole point. In 1985, something interesting happened in this case. In 1985, Mark Furman responded to a call on Rockingham. Mark Furman is a lying, perjuring, genocidal racist. And from that moment on, anytime he could get O.J. Simpson, he would do it. That's when it started in 85, when Farrell asked all the officers at West LA, or 10 of them, you know anything about this residence? Only one steps forward. And what does he say? It's indelibly impressed in my mind, that call back in 85, 4 years later, sits down and writes a report. And now, he knew what he was going to do on this particular night. So, O.J. not a suspect, went to save lives. They wanted to get a search warrant. That's why they were lying. Denies the statement to Wax and Fiala. Then, to get that search warrant, he lies to a judge. He says in the search warrant that O.J. left unexpectedly from Chicago. And there's some writing on the search warrant. I think it's in evidence. And it's kind of interesting because everybody knew. Cato knew he was going to Chicago. Everybody knew he was going to Chicago. It wasn't any unexpected trip, but I suppose it would help out. In fact, you think about it, Ms. Clark said this. Well, that's why those socks were out there and everything, because he left in a hurry. Like he had one pair of socks. You know why those socks were out there. He left unexpectedly to try and justify what they were doing. It all comes back to Furman when he says in that letter, if I see an interracial couple, I'll stop them. If I don't have a reason, I'll make up a reason. This man thinks he's above the law. Even Mr. Christopher Darden, my friend, has to admit, he said it was textbook what's happened to their witness, not our witness. And so he lies to the judge. He lied to the judge. He's lied to you as jurors. Then he says that Arnell and Cato said O.J. left unexpectedly. That's written in the warrant. Never said any of the kind. Cato knew this was a planned trip for Hertz. They talked to Kathy Randa. Then in the search warrant, he puts that it was confirmed there was human blood on the door. That's never been tested, even to this day. Another lie in this search warrant. He denies telling Thompson the order to handcuff O.J. Simpson. Then he lies about O.J. Simpson's blood. Remember during his testimony, he got that blood about 2:30, and he was trying to push it back an hour, so we'll like maybe 3:30, because he had to explain. It's hard to explain those hours in there. What's he walking around with this man's blood for? For 3 hours before he goes back out to Rockingham at 5:30? What's he doing with this blood? So he has an hour in there, and you look at his testimony, he lies about it between 2:30 and 3:30. Then Furman testifies between these two. I don't know who you can believe. When Furman testifies, something about that, when he talks to Cato, Cato tells him about these thumps, that he doesn't tell anybody about it. He's so central to this case. He's got to be the big man and go solve this entire case. He doesn't tell the rest of them. Remember, he goes off all by himself for 15 minutes. Just walking around, he goes off by himself somewhere, supposedly where he supposedly finds this glove. No opportunity? We'll be talking about that. Van Adder comes in and says, well, yes, Furman told me about the thumps on the wall, contrary to what Furman had said. So these are the lies of the co-lead detective in this case. If you cannot trust the messenger, you can't trust the message that they're trying to give you. You can't trust the message.
Context of white supremacy. Doesn't fit. Must acquit. Our final book study session on Jeffrey Toobin's The Run of His Life. The People versus O.J. Simpson. Last section. Doesn't fit. Must acquit. That was a snippet of the closing argument from Johnny L. Cochran Jr. The closing arguments for both sides lasted hours, days, literally. So you certainly did not hear anything close to the totality of what Johnny Cochran said. Barry Scheck also had some time at the closing arguments, but that is just a snippet of what he had to say that led to the exoneration of Arunthal James Simpson. We will go ahead and get started. Before we get to the actual text, we'll hear the rebuttal, if you will, of Fred Goldman. Then we will get to the actual text. Context of white supremacy. This is Jeffrey Toobin's The Run of His Life. Final installment. But first, Fred Goldman.
Nearly 40 minutes out of an hour, we have seen a man who perhaps is the worst kind of racist himself, someone who shoves racism in front of everything, someone who compares a person who speaks racist comments to Hitler, a person who murdered millions of people. This man is the worst kind of human being imaginable. He compares racism of its worst kind in this world to what's going on in this case. He has suggested that racism is the foundation of the police department, of our justice system, and only these jurors are capable of fixing everything that has been going on in history? This man is sick! He is absolutely sick! He walks around for the past days screaming, if you would, in a silent way, that his life has been threatened. And who does he choose to walk with? Guards from the Nation of Islam. He's talking about racism, and he talks about hate? Who does he connect himself with? This man is a horror walking around amongst us, and he compares what Mark Furman did to misery from the beginnings of history. This man ought to be ashamed of himself to walk amongst decent human beings. This man is a disgrace to human beings. No. He is one of the most disgusting human beings I have ever had to listen to in my life. He suggests that racism ought to be the most important thing that any one of us ought to listen to in this court, that any one of us in this nation should be listening to. And it's because of racism we should put aside all other thought, all other reason, and set his murdering client free. He's a sick man, and he ought to be put away. He's a disgusting human being.
Chapter 23. Free O.J. One night, toward the end of the Furman Tapes controversy, many leading figures of the African-American community in Los Angeles filled the vast Santa Monica Civic Auditorium for the annual Soul Train Lady of Soul Awards. Gladys Knight hosted this annual salute to black women in show business. And at the climax of the nationally televised broadcast of the ceremony, she said she had a special announcement. To present the Lena Horne Award for Outstanding Career Achievements, Knight said, "Here is a man who has been a wonderful friend to all of us, a longtime supporter of everything good and positive that takes place in our community. Mr. Johnny Cochran." Cochran appeared from behind a curtain, splendidly turned out in a perfect tuxedo and bright red cummerbund. The audience of 3,000 burst into loud cheers when Cochran stepped forward, a greeting that quickly turned into a standing ovation, the warmest greeting any celebrity received at the event that evening. A handful of spectators started a chant, which spread in a few seconds to the entire crowd. "Free O.J. Free O.J. Free O.J." Standing at center stage, Cochran acknowledged the cheer with a pontifical wave. "I promise I'll work hard to do that," he said. Then he turned to introduce a brief highlight film of the life of the Career Achievement winner, actress and dancer Debbie Allen. These highlights, Cochran told the group with a knowing smile, amounted to what I would call concrete visual evidence. This was real evidence, as opposed to that which Cochran spent his work week examining. By the end of the trial, Cochran had become his client's surrogate, and the lawyer took every opportunity to promote the Simpson cause outside the courtroom. After court nearly every Friday during the last weeks of the trial, Cochran headed for the airport en route to speaking engagements around the country, including journeys to Florida, South Carolina, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Washington, and around California. In his remarks, he invariably seized on the Simpson case as the paradigmatic civil rights issue of the day. On August 20th in Philadelphia, for example, Cochran urged the National Association of Black Journalists to take on the forces of this country. "If you do that, you are using journalism for good. And if you duck this fight, you'll leave a gaping hole, and the battle for civil rights is lost." Cochran charged that coverage of the Simpson trial had been too oriented toward the victims. "Even Simpson himself was a victim," he told the audience of 1,500. "We believe he is wrongfully charged, and he too became a victim, but there has been no talk about that." Paraphrasing the novelist Richard Wright, Cochran told the gathered reporters, "We black folk are history. We are cast in the familiar role as America's conscience." Cochran was even more explicit when, following the last week of testimony in the Simpson trial, he traveled to Washington and spoke before an adoring crowd at the annual legislative conference of the Congressional Black Caucus. In his speech there, he called the trial in Los Angeles the latest landmark in the long civil rights struggle of African Americans, a series of events that, as he summarized it, included Plessy v. Ferguson, Brown v. Board of Education, the Rodney King trial, and yes, even the Simpson case. It is difficult to determine with precision what impact Cochran's speeches had on the jury. In interviews after the trial, jurors said they had been unaware of Cochran's specific public assertions about the case. Yet Cochran's behavior over the course of the entire case, both in court and especially in public toward the end, attempted to define the case solely in racial terms. By the end of the case, all the jurors did know how contentious a national civil rights issue the trial had become. Thus, Cochran's waving of the bloody shirt of racial resentment must be judged a tactical success. When excused juror Jeanette Harris paraphrased the worries of jurors in the case, an African American might say, "I can't say he's guilty because I want to walk out of here." She reflected the heightened political sensitivities about the case, which Cochran helped foment. Cochran's high public profile had another impact as well. It drove Robert Shapiro crazy. In part, Shapiro's reaction arose from simple jealousy over the attention paid to Cochran, especially in comparison with his own ever more negligible role in the defense. Also, as racial perceptions over the case hardened, Shapiro's position in his own white world grew ever more uncomfortable. In this respect, Cochran had nothing but contempt for Shapiro's uneasiness. "I know Shapiro's problem," Cochran said to allies on the defense team, "but I'm a hero in my community." I had an unusually direct view of Shapiro's dilemma. In May 1995, Mark Furman filed a libel suit against me, The New Yorker, and Shapiro in connection with my original story about Furman the previous year. Furman would drop his case during the week of the verdict. Although Shapiro had generally steered clear of me after that issue of The New Yorker ran, the libel case started his competitive juices flowing, and we often talked about it in the courthouse hallway. In short order, however, Shapiro would turn these conversations into diatribes against his colleagues on the defense team, especially Cochran, even more than Bailey. One day during the presentation of the defense case, for example, Shapiro told me that Cochran had interrupted him when he was talking to a lawyer for one of the witnesses. "I'm shaking hands with this lawyer, and you know what he says to me?" Shapiro recounted. "He says, 'We got no time for chit-chat. We gotta work now.'" Shapiro went on, "I've never been treated this way in my life. It's like they want me to look bad. In front of the jury, they give me questions to ask, and they're bad questions." The heart of Shapiro's complaints always returned, however, to publicity. "Johnny keeps track of what show everyone is on. He watches everything. He doesn't work. It's unbelievable." Shapiro did have a point about Cochran's obsession with the media, which of course was matched by Shapiro's. On September 7th, for example, Cochran sent a memo to all the defense attorneys saying, "Effective immediately, per Mr. O.J. Simpson's request, all media appearances must be approved by yours truly. There will be no exceptions to this policy." Cochran and his allies, for their part, more than returned Shapiro's disdain for them, and with perhaps even greater justification. On another day, during the defense case, Shapiro's fellow defense team members caught him using a miniature dictaphone in his pocket to record a meeting in the courthouse lockup among Simpson and his lawyers. As Shapiro later admitted, he was surreptitiously documenting these meetings so he could include them in the book he was planning to write about the case. Scheck and Neufeld, who believed strongly in the sanctity of the attorney-client privilege, were beside themselves with outrage at Shapiro over the tape recording. On the rare occasions that Shapiro deigned to attend defense team meetings, the atmosphere was poisonous. To their credit, the prosecutors did not turn on each other in the waning days of the trial, but they didn't entertain any great hopes of victory either. By and large, they felt doomed by even the small number of excerpts that Ito had allowed from McKinney's tapes. Still, the prosecution put together a smashing start to its brief rebuttal case, one the increasingly stupefied jury seemed barely to notice and would scarcely comment upon after the trial. The rebuttal case began with the one positive bit of fallout from Darden's glove fiasco. Amateur photographers around the country began searching their files for photographs of Simpson wearing leather gloves at football games. Several found examples, which they sent to the prosecution in Los Angeles. The first, taken on December 29, 1990, at a Chicago Bears game, was the most striking. The glove not only had identical features to the Eris model, recovered in 1994, but this glove also looked tight on Simpson's hand, just as the evidence gloves had. Richard Rubin, the glove expert, returned to the stand to say that he was 100% certain that the gloves in the photographs were those rare Eris Lights, style 70263. Neither side wanted to give the other the last word, so the case wound down like a dying metronome, with each side calling a final few witnesses. The defense closed on a quasi-comic note, calling a pair of organized crime informants, the brothers Larry and Tony, the animal Fiato. With their earrings and dyed hair, this duo looked like extras from a low-budget crime picture, but they actually served the defense cause very well. The Fiato brothers had worked as informants in an unrelated criminal case investigated by Detective Tom Lang, Phil Van Adder's partner. In January 1995, just as the Simpson trial was getting underway, the Fiatos were preparing for their testimony in one of these other cases when they started chattering with Van Adder. The topic turned to the Simpson case and the detective's controversial decision to leave the murder scene and go to O.J.'s home on Rockingham. They claimed that Van Adder said, apparently sarcastically, "We didn't go up there with the intention of saving lives. He was the suspect." In a final day of testimony, September 19th, the defense called four witnesses: Van Adder, Michael Wax, an FBI agent who was present, and the two Fiato brothers, to testify about this conversation. All essentially agreed about what Van Adder had said, and all pretty much concluded that it seemed the detective had been joking. Yet the whole scene left a seedy impression of Van Adder in particular, and the police as a whole. The defense succeeded at the last moment in raising a series of embarrassing questions. Was Van Adder's long-questioned justification for going to Rockingham really true? What did he really tell the Fiato brothers? Why was the co-lead detective discussing the Simpson case at all with a pair of mafia informants? All these questions hung awkwardly in the air as the jury was about to get the case. Yet the prosecutors couldn't leave well, or badly, enough alone. Rather than simply ignore the Fiato sideshow, the prosecutors decided to call one final, final witness, the last of the trial, and one who served rather well as an emblem for the futility of the government's efforts in this case. On the morning of September 20th, Marcia Clark called Keith D. Bushy, the Ramrod Straight police officer who had served as the top LAPD administrator for the western quarter of the city in June 1994. Bushy testified that Detective Ron Phillips had called him at about 2:30 a.m. on June 13th to inform him that Nicole Brown Simpson's body had been found. Bushy said that on hearing the news, he remembered that several members of John Belushi's family had heard of his death through the news media. Bushy thought that was unfortunate, so, he said, he ordered Phillips to find O.J. Simpson just as soon as humanly possible and notify O.J. Simpson of his ex-wife's death. Clark thus wanted to use Bushy to convince the jury that Van Adder and the other detectives really had been telling the truth all along, that they went over to Rockingham to notify Simpson that his ex-wife had died. The imperious Bushy never knew what hit him on cross-examination. Johnny Cochran understood the LAPD better than any of the prosecutors. He knew how the police groveled before celebrities. The sinister brilliance of his examination of Bushy, and indeed of his defense in general, was that he made the preferential treatment accorded Simpson look like a different, more nefarious kind of singling out. Cochran knew that Bushy would have to lie, that he couldn't admit that celebrities won special favors from the LAPD, So Cochran spun those lies to his client's advantage. Are you saying that the LAPD department in this case gave preferential treatment by sending four detectives to O.J. Simpson's house in the early morning hours? Cochran asked. No, Bushy replied. First of all, I don't like the word preferential treatment. Okay, Cochran parried. That was the word used by the prosecution. Well, I don't care, Bushy answered. You don't like the word preferential because on the side of the police car it says protect and serve all the people? That's correct. You're supposed to treat all people alike, aren't you? We tried to, Bushy answered glumly. And fair. You try? Sure, said Bushy. Cochran found the heart of the issue a moment later when he asked, In the course of your responsibilities that morning, were you more concerned about the department's image than you were about investigating these very brutal murders? Certainly not, said Bushy. But the truth was very much the opposite. The prosecution thus unaccountably completed its presentation in the O.J. Simpson murder case with a pious double-talking fixture of the LAPD brass. And that might not have been even the worst of it, for in addition to everything else, Keith Bushy was a dead ringer for the most hated man in Black Los Angeles, the former chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, Daryl Gates. From the day he was hired in the case, Cochran teased the press with the possibility of Simpson testifying in his own defense. The lawyer said repeatedly that he wanted O.J. to testify, and that O.J. himself wanted to testify. But these comments were just public relations. With the exception of Bailey, who actually did want Simpson to take the stand, no one on the defense team ever took the idea very seriously. Bailey thought, with good reason, that Simpson would have no chance of resuming anything like his former life unless he addressed the charges from the witness stand. Cochran and Shapiro were more worried about losing the case, and their view prevailed. Still, even in jail, Simpson was as obsessed as ever by his image, and Cochran found an opportunity for him to put his point across. As part of the formalities of ending the case, Ito had to ask Simpson on September 22nd whether he waived his right to testify. Cochran, in turn, requested that Simpson be allowed to make a brief statement as part of his waiver. Even though the jury was not present, Clark objected, saying that this is a very obvious defense bid to get material admitted through these conjugal visits that is not admitted in court. Please don't do this, Your Honor. I beg you. Cochran replied with great indignation. There seems to be this great fear of the truth in this case, he said. This is still America, and we can talk, we can speak. Nobody can stop us. A rather odd complaint on behalf of a client who had already written a best-selling book from jail. Ito caved, and Simpson rose to deliver a soundbite for the evening news. Good morning, Your Honor, he said. As much as I would like to address some of the misrepresentations made about myself and Nicole concerning our life together, I'm mindful of the mood and the stamina of this jury. I have confidence, a lot more it seems than Miss Clark has, of their integrity, and that they'll find, as the record stands now, that I did not, would not, and could not have committed this crime. I have four kids. Two kids I haven't seen in a year. They asked me every week, Dad, how much longer? This was more than even Ito could take, and he cut Simpson off with a curt, All right, Simpson said, I want this trial over. Even this brief monologue offered a useful insight into Simpson's character. Throughout the trial, his obsession remained the misrepresentations about his relationship with Nicole, especially the notion that he was imploring Nicole to come back to him. Typically, too, he attributed his decision not to testify to the mood and stamina of the jury, when the real reason had more to do with his lead lawyer's belief in his guilt. The statement was, in short, another snapshot of Simpson's narcissism. Tuesday, September 26th, 1995, broke chilly and drizzly. During the fall and winter of the previous year, Southern California had been afflicted with some of the coldest and wettest weather in recent history. A normal spring and summer, hot and dry, had followed. Now, on the day that summations were to begin, it appeared that the seasons had changed once more. Jury selection had commenced 365 days earlier. The trial of O.J. Simpson had taken 1 year. Even before she uttered her first words to the jury, Marcia Clark was exhausted, with large half-moons of purple under each eye. She looked emaciated beneath her simple beige jacket. The chicken salads delivered to her office every lunch hour had often gone untouched. Not so her silver cigarette lighter, the one inscribed with the words Truth and Justice. For all these months, she had fueled herself with an unending relay of Dunhills. First, Clark thanked the jury, which was customary but not for her, heartfelt. She and her colleagues had traveled a long way since the optimistic close to jury selection. Over the course of the trial, Clark had felt no warmth from this group, no sympathy for the victims, no core of emotional revulsion at the murders. Clark's instincts about juries had not entirely deserted her, even if enlightenment came far too late. She had come to see that these were fearful jurors, more concerned about the reaction to their verdict than about reaching the right one. They took few notes. They never smiled or frowned. They gave no sense of themselves away. They were too frightened to reveal anything. As the race issue took over the case, the prosecutors knew above all that they needed a courageous jury, and they sensed, correctly as it turned out, that they didn't have one. Clark's first words about the facts of the case included a revealing slip of the tongue. "Let me come back to Mark Furman for a minute," she said. Actually, she had not mentioned him before, so she was not really coming back to him. It just seemed that way, for the defense had succeeded so completely in making Furman the center of this case. Like it or not, everyone in this trial was always coming back to Mark Furman. "Did he lie when he testified here in this courtroom, saying that he did not use racial epithets in the last 10 years? Clark continued. "Yes." "Is he a racist?" "Yes." "Is he the worst LAPD has to offer?" "Yes." "Do we wish that this person was never hired by LAPD?" "Yes." "Should LAPD have ever hired him?" "No." "In fact, do we wish there were no such person on the planet?" "Yes." But the fact that Mark Furman is a racist and lied about it on the witness stand does not mean that we haven't proven the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And it would be a tragedy if, with such overwhelming evidence, ladies and gentlemen, as we have presented to you, you found the defendant not guilty in spite of all that because of the racist attitudes of one police officer. This immediate and categorical denunciation of Furman was probably the best Clark could have done under the circumstances. But it also underlined how the racial issue paralyzed the prosecution. Yes, Furman was racist, but Simpson was still guilty. The yes-slash-but formulation represented the dominant motif of the summation that followed over the next 5 hours. Yes, the investigation had been imperfect. Yes, the criminalists made mistakes, but the evidence led only to this defendant. Clark was rushed and a little scattered as she attempted to pull all the complex strands of evidence together, but still she delivered an adequate, professional summation and a persuasive one for a jury willing to listen. In one passage, Clark drew on the vast changes the trial had wrought in her own life. She thought the jurors might wonder just what Simpson had been doing in the narrow passageway behind Kalen's room, the place where he knocked into the air conditioner and dropped the glove. "You are thinking, why not drop it in a dumpster on the way home?" she said. But Clark suggested that this wasn't possible. "He can't. He can't because he is famous. If someone sees him hanging around near a dumpster on that night of all nights, they're going to recognize him, and he is going to have a witness." Clark came up with this theory because now she, too, was noticed everywhere she went, and she believed that Simpson, who had far more experience in being famous, had even factored his celebrity into his plans for murder. In her fury at Darden after the glove demonstration, Clark had decided for a while that she didn't want him doing any part of the summations. She would do it all herself. But Clark's anger cooled, and she ultimately ceded the domestic violence portion of the case to him. Ito had decreed that there would be evening sessions during closing statements, so Darden rose to address the jury at shortly after 7 in the evening. Television, of course, was sending the proceedings around the world, but this first nighttime session of the case gave the courtroom a curious intimacy. We were, after all, nearly the only people in that vast and sterile building, and the uniqueness of the experience gave the room a strange glow. Chris Darden captured that mood and that moment. This case, chiefly Cochran's race-baiting, had taken its toll on Darden. The public display of his shortcomings as a lawyer had pained him as well. Darden had a great deal of help with this summation. It was written chiefly by fellow prosecutor Scott Gordon and a private stalking and domestic violence expert named Gavin DeBecker. But just as Darden deserved the blame for his several failures in that courtroom, so too did he earn the credit for this triumph. Darden used a perfect metaphor for the Simpson marriage, a burning fuse. He noted that the defense had argued that just because there was marital discord, it doesn't mean anything. Well, this isn't a just-because issue. This is a because issue. It is because he hit her in the past, and because he slapped her and threw her out of the house and kicked her and punched her and grabbed her around the neck. And it's because he used a baseball bat to break the windshield of her Mercedes back in 1985. And it's because he kicked her door down in 1993. It's because of a letter he wrote her, June the 6th, talking about the IRS. It's because he stalked her. Darden then took each of these domestic violence incidents in chronological order and punctuated them with the phrase, "And the fuse is burning." He played the pair of 911 calls, the wordless slaps from 1989, and the terrified, "He's going to kill me," from 4 years later. Darden closed for the night by recalling one of the briefest witnesses in the trial, the district attorney's investigator who drilled open Nicole's safe deposit box after her death. There wasn't much in there. Her will, letters of apology from O.J. after his 1989 conviction, and the photographs of Nicole's beaten face from that incident. But Darden asserted that Nicole had a larger purpose for preserving those few items in the way she did. "She put those things there for a reason," Darden said quietly. "She is leaving you a road map to let you know who it is who will eventually kill her. She knew in 1989. She knew it. And she wants you to know it." The defense team held weekly meetings around a big table in Cochran's suite of offices. At these conclaves, Cochran would often take on the persona of a preacher and declaim in mock solemnity about each lawyer's assignment. One day, near the end of the case, Cochran was telling Bailey his plans for how they were going to win. "I will bring the brothers and sisters to the table of acquittal," he told Bailey, "but you, sir, are responsible for the demon." The demon was the defense team's nickname for juror number 3, Anise Aschenbach, a 60-year-old woman who was one of only 2 whites left on the panel. The self-confident and poised Aschenbach had said during jury selection that her advocacy once changed the minds of all 11 of her fellow jurors in another case. Throughout the trial, Aschenbach was the one juror the defense feared might hold out for conviction. Along the way, Cochran and Bailey sensed that she particularly admired Bailey's courtroom style, which led to Cochran's instruction to him. In fact, the defense missed Aschenbach's signals about Bailey. "I couldn't stand that creep," she told me after the trial. Still, the admonition to Bailey illustrated how Johnny Cochran saw his role in the case. He would take care of the 9 black jurors, the brothers and sisters, and one of the white lawyers could handle the rest. In the waning days of the trial, Shapiro lobbied Simpson to be allowed to deliver the second defense summation, but Cochran and the rest of the defense team shot down that idea. Shapiro didn't know the facts well enough. He would only be reading what Barry Sheck had prepared for him. Simpson, too, thought Scheck deserved the white lawyer slot. Bailey had played too small a role in the trial even to be considered. When Cochran began his address to the jury on Wednesday, September 27th, he started in a conventional way. He attacked the prosecutor's timeline, principally their theory that Simpson had killed the two victims at 10:15 p.m. He dwelled on the glove demonstration and used a catchy phrase that had been suggested to him by Jerry Ullman. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Cochran continued to ignore or downplay domestic violence. He is not perfect. He is not proud of some of the things he did. The lawyer said at last, but they don't add up to murder. Cochran even took a silly turn when he put a black knit cap on his head to suggest the absurdity of someone as famous as O.J. Simpson using a disguise. If I put this knit cap on, who am I? Cochran asked. I'm still Johnny Cochran with a knit cap. In fact, wearing a knit cap at night can be an effective disguise, one favored in particular by the Navy SEALs, who had been Simpson's tutors on the set of Frogman shortly before the murders. But Cochran was only warming up to the crux of his argument about the LAPD. If you can't trust the messengers, watch out for their messages. Van Adder, the man who carries the blood. Furman, the man who finds the glove. Cochran realized that Furman's role in the case was, in the end, fairly minor, so he threw Van Adder in with a disgraced Furman. Cochran even had a chart for the jury, entitled Van Adder's Big Lies, and he called the two men the Twins of Deception, and then the Twin Demons of Deception, and finally the Twin Devils of Deception. This was, of course, monstrously unfair to Van Adder, whose errors stemmed more from laziness than malevolence. This was, in the end, the classic Johnny Cochran summation, a variant of one he had given many times before. He said the case was really about the police, not his client. The only difference in this case was that the stakes were so much higher. "Your verdict goes far beyond these doors of this courtroom," he advised. "That's not to put any pressure on you, just to tell you what is really happening out there." It was, one supposes, just a sort of courtesy to warn the jurors what their lives might be like if they happened to vote to convict this man. So what was the jury to do? "Stop this cover-up. Stop this cover-up. If you don't stop it, then who? Do you think the police department is going to stop it? Do you think the DA's office is going to stop it? Do you think we can stop it by ourselves? It has to be stopped by you." Who then polices the police? You police the police. You police them by your verdict. You are the ones to send the message. Several times he referred to Furman as a genocidal racist, so that there was only one appropriate point of reference for this man. "There was another man not too long ago in the world who had those same views. This man, this scourge, became one of the worst people in the history of this world, Adolf Hitler, because people didn't, or didn't try, to stop him. He had the power over his racism and his anti-religion. Nobody wanted to stop him, and it ended up in World War II. Cochran then exhaled and muttered with disgust, "The conduct of this man." And it wasn't too clear who, Hitler or Furman. Scheck followed for a brisk tour of the forensic issues in the case. It was at times extremely arcane. The EAP typing system is something that looks at antigens on the outside of that red blood cell. But Scheck did make clear the defense position that the police had cleverly planted the blood on the socks at Rockingham and on the rear gate at Bundy, though at the same time they had incompetently contaminated the blood on the walkway at Bundy. The unifying theme came from Henry Lee. "In the words of Dr. Lee," Scheck said, "something is wrong. Something is terribly wrong with the evidence in this case." That evening, the last night of the case, the prosecutors gathered on the 18th floor to plot strategy for a rebuttal. Bedeviled by dental problems for years, Clark was now finding the pain excruciating. She made an emergency appointment with a dentist at 6:30 that evening, and it turned out she had an abscess. She was knocked out with general anesthesia, operated on, and sent back to the courthouse at around 10 p.m. She stayed until just before 4 in the morning. 5 hours later, on September 29th, the prosecutor spoke for the last time. Frazzled and drained, Clark unwisely tried to respond to each of Scheck's assertions. The defense lawyers interrupted her more than 40 times with objections. Ito overruled most of them, but they succeeded in preventing Clark from establishing any kind of rhythm. For once, Clark lacked the energy to fight back. There was one hint of what was to come. Bill Hodgman had spent much of the previous month working on an elaborate chart entitled Unrefuted Evidence, a summary of all the non-DNA, non-Furman-related evidence in the case. It was arranged in the form of a big pyramid, and Clark saved it for her conclusion. The chart was extremely impressive, and it listed things like Nicole's purchase of the gloves, Park's fruitless buzzing for Simpson, the blood to the left of the shoe prints, and the cut on Simpson's left hand. It was a rather complicated graphic, and Clark did not discuss every point on it, so she offered the jurors an option. "If you would like to take notes on this," Clark said, "I can leave it up for a little while." Not one juror wrote down a thing. When I left Ito's courtroom on September 29th and stood before the steam tables in the cafeteria of the criminal courts building, I had only one thought. Praise be the last lunch, at least before deliberations. Clark's haggard appearance reflected the feelings of everyone involved with the trial. I ordered my umpteenth chicken burrito and staggered to a table with Sally Ann Stewart, a reporter for USA Today. The room was uncharacteristically deserted for that time of day, and we enjoyed the calm as we discussed the end of the trial and the resumption of our normal lives. A few moments later, though, Johnny Cochran, Barry Scheck, Carl Douglas, and Larry Schiller arrived. They set their trays down at a centrally located table, and six Fruit of Islam bodyguards, dressed in their trademark bow ties, formed a circle with their backs to Cochran's table and their eyes trained warily outward. The guards had first appeared in the courthouse at the beginning of that final week, and had added a new level of uneasiness to an environment that was already extraordinarily charged. In truth, Cochran was probably more miser than provocateur. Cochran had received threats, and what really appealed to him about the Fruit of Islam guards was that they had volunteered their services. Still, after the Furman tapes and after all of his fiery speeches around the country, Cochran had imported into the courthouse the very symbols of Louis Farrakhan's strident black nationalism. At that Friday lunch, however, the presence of the grim-faced sentries seemed merely ludicrous, for they had only two reporters and Rose, the cashier, to monitor for false moves. Then a few minutes later, Robert Shapiro arrived. There had been a time when he was probably the most famous lawyer in America, but by this final Friday, his voluble, visible role had been usurped. Though the other defense lawyers often came and went together, Shapiro arrived and left by himself. And on this day he paid Rose, took a long look at his colleagues and their sentinels, and sat down by himself at a small table nearby. Sally and I, feeling a little sorry for him and always eager to chat with an insider, asked him to sit with us. He picked up his tray, sidled over, and joined in our reveries of life after O.J. His own fantasy, he said, would be to take a month off and join Oscar De La Hoya's training camp at Big Bear Lake. A serious and skilled amateur boxer at the age of 53, he couldn't wait to tear into the heavy bag. As always with Shapiro, though, the topic soon turned to his resentment of his fellow defense lawyers. He said he had been appalled when Cochrane brought the fruit of Islam into his entourage, and that he had been disappointed by Cochrane's summation the previous day. It was nothing but race, 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 he said. And why am I not reading that in the paper? All I hear is how great his summation was. Why do I keep reading this? In truth, some reporters had exoriated Cochrane's appeal for an acquittal based on racial solidarity, but Shapiro's bitterness was such that he had registered only the favorable words about his colleague. Meanwhile, Marcia Clark took the Goldman family out for a drink after her rebuttal summation on Friday. She then fled Los Angeles. She took her two boys up the coast to Santa Barbara, to the home of her friend, Len Reed Barragona. There, Clark slept in peace, played with her kids, and did the crossword puzzle for the first time in more than a year. On Sunday, Clark and Barragona decided to take a trip to the local mall. Amid the upscale stores in that Tony Pacific Ocean setting, Clark started to absorb just how famous she had become. As she shopped, she encountered spontaneous outbursts of applause from fellow customers. Toward the end of the day, Clark and her friend were walking along a long corridor, and a pair of black women started coming toward them from the opposite direction. They were, it seemed, just about the only African-American shoppers in the whole place, and they clearly recognized the Simpson prosecutor. As their paths crossed, one of the black women leaned over and uttered a single word, just loud enough so that Marcia Clark would hear. Innocent. The jurors selected a foreperson on the afternoon of Friday, September 29th, just after Clark completed the last summation. The assignment went to juror number one, Armanda Cooley, a 51-year-old black woman who worked as an administrative assistant for the city of Los Angeles. Cooley was obviously a level-headed and friendly person, and she had steered clear of most of the jury tempests during the trial. Both sides figured she would be the choice. Judge Ito did not allow the jury to begin considering the evidence on that Friday, however. After they selected the foreperson, Ito sent them back to the hotel. Deliberations were set to begin on Monday morning. Shortly before summations, the sheriff's deputies supervising the jurors at the Intercontinental Hotel told their charges that they would have to start preparing for the end of their sequestration. Through 8 months at the hotel, the jurors had accumulated a great many possessions in their rooms. The deputies told them that by the time of deliberations, all of their belongings would have to fit into one or two suitcases. Over the last weekend, the deputies made an additional announcement to the jurors. On Monday, and on each day of deliberations to follow, the jurors would be required to pack all of their remaining belongings and take them to the courthouse. This was a major imposition. It also made no sense, because once the jurors reached their verdict, Ito had decided that he was going to delay the announcement overnight. Yet the jurors, beaten down after so many months of confinement, did not protest. They accepted the prospect of rising daily at dawn and packing, then rushing off to court at their usual 7:45 a.m., for as long as it would take to reach a verdict. But this pointlessly strict policy by the sheriff's deputies represented at least a subconscious cue to the jurors to reach a quick decision. At 9:16 a.m. on Monday, October 2nd, the 12 members of the jury settled into chairs in the deliberation room just across the back hallway from Ito's courtroom. 25 minutes later, Ito's clerk, Deidre Robertson, wheeled in a cart piled high with trial exhibits arrayed in black binders. Robertson closed the door and said the jurors could begin discussing the case. Armanda Cooley, the foreperson, asked her colleagues for advice about how to proceed. She had never before served on a jury. Several of the jurors suggested that they take an immediate straw poll, but Cooley said that a manual she had been given seemed to suggest that the jury should not call for a show of hands. After a little more discussion, it was agreed that Cooley would conduct a vote by secret ballot, just to get a sense of what everyone was thinking. Just write guilty or not guilty on a piece of paper and put it in the bowl, Cooley said. After a moment or two, Cooley passed around a glass bowl that Ito's clerks had kept full of candy over the previous months. When the bowl came back to Cooley, her friend, Carrie Bess, like Cooley, a single black woman with grown children and a civil service job, volunteered to tabulate the responses on a blackboard. Cooley called out the votes, and Bess wrote them down. 10 for acquittal, 2 for conviction. Turning for the first time to the facts of the case, Anish Aschenbach, the defense's white demon, announced she wanted to say something. She had been stewing all weekend. Aschenbach had been so angry during Cochran's summation that she almost got up and told the lawyer to shut up. I was so outraged at what he said. Aschenbach told her fellow jurors, he wants us to send the LAPD a message. Does he think we're so stupid that we're going to send a message rather than decide based on what we heard in the case? I hope I was not the only one offended by his remarks. Her fellow jurors responded to these comments with total silence. Armanda Cooley decided to distribute the exhibit binders. Jurors began leafing through them and offering comments about the evidence. It wasn't so much a conversation as a series of random observations. Why wasn't there more blood around the glove Furman said he found at Rockingham? Goldman had bruises on his knuckles. If they were from fighting back, why didn't O.J. have any bruises on his body? The prosecution had argued that Goldman had injured his hand, flailing against the fence behind him. The jurors knew that Dave Aldana, the Hispanic man in seat 4, was a martial arts expert. He got up and demonstrated how to defend in Taekwondo. He thought Goldman had put up a good fight. If the glove came off Simpson's hand during the fight, why wasn't it inside out? Aschenbach volunteered that she was one of the 2 votes for conviction. The other never came forward. Hearing this, Sheila Woods flashed an angry look at her. Woods was the last surviving member of the Jeanette Harris clique. Since Harris had been thrown off the jury, Woods had had little contact with her fellow jurors. Why did they go after him as a suspect from the beginning? Woods said to Aschenbach. They insulted us with their testimony. They went after that man. Someone mentioned the glove demonstration. Brenda Morin, Gina Roseborough, and Lon Cryer all said they thought it didn't fit on Simpson's hand. There was only one reference to DNA tests. Both Dave Aldana and Sheila Woods said they didn't think it was reliable when all of the DNA came from the back gate at Bundy. This was important to them. It was, of course, completely wrong, too. While the molecular weight of the DNA on the back gate was higher than that of the other samples, several other tests of blood at the murder scene tied it to Simpson. After about an hour of discussion, the topic turned to the testimony of Alan Park, the limousine driver. Carrie Bess said Park didn't know how many cars had been in Simpson's driveway. A couple of other jurors disagreed about whether Park had seen a black man at the doorway to the house or walk across the driveway. Others were confused by the time that Park said various events occurred. The group decided by consensus that they would like another look at Park's testimony. Shortly before noon, Cooley sent out a note requesting Park's testimony. She thought the judge would simply send back a transcript the jury could examine, but the judge relayed word that he would have the testimony read in the courtroom starting at 1 o'clock p.m. The jurors then broke for lunch. As a former prosecutor, I have always hated readbacks. Even when I was trying my own cases, I used to have trouble staying awake when court reporters did their monotone recitals. This day was no different. I took my usual seat and tried to focus on the words as they were spoken. As he had from the beginning, Park struck me as the most powerful government witness in the case. It was absolutely clear that the Bronco was not parked on Rockingham when he arrived to pick up Simpson. Its absence, in my view, doomed O.J. Even worse, from Simpson's perspective, was that Park was fairly certain that the Bronco had returned by the time they left for the airport. An even more incriminating fact. Still, when Ito called a break after 75 minutes of the readback to give the court reporter's voice a rest, I knew I had to escape. I was sure there were going to be lots of readbacks to come, and I didn't want to embarrass myself by falling asleep in court. I wandered up to the 18th floor and paid a visit to Scott Gordon, the good-natured former Santa Monica cop, who was the leading domestic violence expert in the DA's office. We had been chatting for about 10 minutes when his phone rang. I heard only his side of the conversation. "You're shitting me." "Don't shit me like this. I know you're shitting me." "Really? Really?" Finally, he hung up. "Looks like we have a verdict," he told me. Back in the jury room, Cooley had taken advantage of the break to ask if all the questions about Park's testimony had been answered. By consensus, the answer was yes. Suddenly, it seemed no one had anything more to say. In lieu of returning to the courtroom for the remainder of Park's testimony, Cooley sent a request to Ito for the verdict forms. Before they arrived, Cooley conducted another secret ballot, and this time the vote was unanimous. Just to make sure, Cooley asked each juror to repeat their verdict, and they all said, "Not guilty." Cooley filled out the forms and pushed the buzzer to the courtroom 3 times. The signal for a verdict. It was shortly before 3 o'clock p.m. The jurors had discussed the merits of the case against O.J. Simpson for about 2 hours, less time than most other adults in America. Cochran was giving a speech in San Francisco. Bailey was appearing at a snack food distributors convention in Laguna Beach. Clark was in her office. Though Simpson had 11 lawyers representing him in this case, only Carl Douglas was by his side when Armanda Cooley presented the envelope containing the completed verdict forms to Judge Ito. "We will accept the verdict from you tomorrow morning at 10, Ito said. "See you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. No one, on either side or in the news media, had predicted so swift a verdict. The entire building seemed afflicted with vertigo. After all these months and all the debates over evidence, strategy, rulings, and rumors, only one question remained. What had the jurors done? I had spent most of the trial believing that it would end in an acquittal or a hung jury. Then the Park testimony threw me. If that's all they needed to hear, I thought, they had voted to convict. The jurors returned to the Intercontinental for their 266th and final night in residence. The hotel threw the jurors a champagne reception in the presidential suite on the 19th floor, then turned their last supper into a steak barbecue. Everyone had a few drinks, which loosened tongues. Rico Butler, one of the two alternates, couldn't resist asking one of the deliberating jurors how it had all come out. The juror couldn't resist answering, "N." The juror said, "Not guilty." This curiosity extended to the sheriff's deputies as well, who had the same question and received the same answer. Back at the county jail, Simpson's lawyers gathered in a final vigil with him. Cochran arrived too late to make it to the jail, but Bailey, Kardashian, and Skip Taft sat on the other side of the glass wall for a last chat. As it turned out, Simpson was in good spirits. "All the deputies here are asking for my autograph," Simpson told his lawyers. "They hear from their boys over with the jury that it's going to be the last chance for them to get one." It was the last leak in the case, from the sheriff's deputies guarding the jury to their colleagues guarding Simpson. OJ was going to walk. The scene at the courthouse on the morning of Tuesday, October 3rd, resembled some sinister carnival. Over the course of the trial, the LAPD had made the criminal court's building ever more isolated. First, they banned all parked cars from the adjacent streets to prevent a car bombing. Then they kept all cars off the main artery of Temple Street, right in front of the building. On this last day, the police shut off all traffic in the immediate vicinity of the courthouse. Crowds of people milled about in the empty streets. Except for the trial, all business in downtown Los Angeles seemed to come to a halt. In the last half hour before 10 o'clock, more than 100 people jammed the hallway outside of Ito's courtroom. Bookers for talk shows had taken up more or less permanent residence in that hallway for weeks. And on this day, several stars of the shows joined in the vigil. NBC had 40 camera crews ready to roll for reaction to the verdict. ABC had assigned 4 producers to each juror. At 9:49, Darden walked into the courtroom alone. 3 minutes later, Clark arrived, with a retinue of 4 police bodyguards. At 9:55, Johnny Cochran, Simpson Sisters, and their Nation of Islam escorts completed the cast in the courtroom. At 1 minute before 10 o'clock, the deputies escorted Simpson from his lockup, and he nodded to his family just as he had every day. For perhaps the first time in the entire trial, Ito appeared and started the proceedings precisely on schedule. "Counsel," Ito said to the lawyers, "is there anything else we need to take up before we invite the jurors to join us?" For once, the answer was no. The jurors filed out in their usual order, expressionless as always. They looked ahead, vacantly. None of them met Simpson's eye. Ito directed Deidre Robertson to hand the envelope containing the verdict forms to one of the sheriff's deputies, who walked it over to Armanda Cooley. "Madam Foreperson," Ito said, "would you please open the envelope and check the condition of the verdict forms?" Cooley did so. "Are they the same forms you signed, and are they in order?" "Yes, they are." Ito cautioned the audience that, if there is any disruption during the reading of the verdicts, the bailiffs will have the obligation to remove any persons disrupting these proceedings. Ito paused. "Mr. Simpson," he instructed, "would you please stand and face the jury?" Unbidden, Cochran and the rest of the defense team rose with him. "Mrs. Robertson," Ito cued. The judge's clerk stumbled as she read the title of the case, then steadied herself as she came to the verdict. "We, the jury, in the above-entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony, upon Nicole Brown Simpson, a human being, as charged in Count 1 of the information." At the words "not guilty," Simpson exhaled and gave a sort of half-smile. He looked like he was going to cry, but didn't. Cochran stood behind him as they faced the jury, and on hearing "not guilty," Cochran pumped his fist quickly, then grabbed Simpson by the shoulder, and in a startlingly intimate gesture, placed his cheek on the back of O.J.'s shoulder. Robert Shapiro looked stricken, crushed. His alienation from his colleagues and client was never more visible than at that moment. Robertson then proceeded to read the second verdict, that in the murder of Ronald Lyle Goldman. At the second utterance of the words "not guilty," Kim Goldman let out a trembling howl. She grabbed her hair, then buried her head in her father's shoulder. I was sitting right behind Kim in the second row. Numb with shock, I stared at Simpson and had a single thought. He's going home. There is no red tape after an acquittal. The handcuffs come off and you're on your way. As Robertson finished the formalities and Ito pulled the jury, asking them all whether this was their verdict, noise from the audience grew louder. Everyone in all of the families was crying, for joy, for sorrow, at their release from this extraordinary tension. "The defendant, having been acquitted of both charges," Ito said evenly, "is ordered released forthwith." "All right, we'll stand in recess." The jurors filed out in their usual silence. From his seat, number 6, juror Lon Cryer had the longest walk to the door. He kept his head down most of the way, then turned to the defense table and raised his fist in a black power salute. Then he, too, left the courtroom. Most of the jurors dissolved into tears when they arrived back in the deliberation room. They hugged and wept and clung to one another for support. After a few minutes, a pair of deputies came to escort them up to the lounge on the 11th floor, where they had done most of their waiting over the course of the trial. There, the tears mostly stopped, and the jurors sat in shell-shocked silence on the couches and easy chairs. Finally, Carrie Bess said something to no one in particular. "We've got to protect our own."
"He's so guilty, we can't free O.J. He's so guilty, we can't free O.J.
Let's string 'em up, 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 hang 'em up, let's string 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 'em up."
In a jail cell, a tiny jail cell, OJ can't sleep tonight. No white women, he'll use his left hand, and then he'll use his right. On the sidewalk, the bloody sidewalk, the OJ sliced his wife. He was crouching and he'll be slouching with his 12-inch knife. We can't free OJ. We can't free OJ. We know he knifed them, he really sliced them, and we must make him pay.
Involved James Simpson, not guilty. Number 4, as to count 1, this is your verdict. Juror number 5, as to count 1, this is your verdict. Juror number 6,
I am ashamed to be an American right now. That jury should be ashamed of themselves for that verdict that they...
Guilty as sin! It's a lousy, sick jury!
Got away with murder, and I think the celebration of this was a very painful blow to the soul of this country. Cochran played the race card, the jury picked it up, and we have been suffering and bleeding ever since.
Makes me upset that I live in this city now. I mean, I was upset before with the riots and all that, but now this is like... I don't know what's going to happen. It's sending a message also to the black community that they can get away with stuff like this.
This jury was a bunch of racists. They think that they did something to help the brothers or to pay back LAPD. I think they hurt themselves.
I think that people that weren't racist now are maybe a little more racist.
Of course we all hate him. With glee we'll end his life. He just keeps lying, but no one's buying. His word was everywhere. Don't let him off, chop his limbs off, set fire to his hair. We can't free OJ. We can't free OJ.
Doesn't fit, must acquit. Gusty Renegade, the black O.J. Simpson. So we are almost done. We have one more section, the epilogue from Jeffrey Toobin. Ooh-wee, you have not heard the tackiness, man. Wait until he gets to comparing this case to the murder trial of Emmett Lewis Till. New depth of tackiness that is coming in the epilogue as we close out the run of his life, Jeffrey Toobin, Zoom Bomber of 2020. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate That number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We'll get to some of the emails, and then we will get to folks who dialed in, final thoughts, the trial, the closing arguments, takeaways from the book, if it made you reassess your original thoughts on the trial, guilt or innocence of Mr. Simpson. We will sum it all up today. First person who wrote in, victim of racism, writes, just finished watching Mr. Cochran's closing argument, all of it. I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. An utter tour de force of brilliance. In addition, he closes with the 15 questions. Those questions are great. To the jury, which is so beautifully clever and sets up the Clark team to fail. The O.J. Simpson case explication has been so illuminating and constructive. I suspected it would be, but it has far exceeded my expectations. That is rare. Like, woof, generally I'm disappointed about things. Interestingly enough, George L. Jackson's book, Blood in My Eye, I have read that, though we have not read it on the book club, makes a number of parallel points that one would find in the O.J. Simpson case with so many pre-man not insights. At any rate, thanks so much for all of this. It has been the best case study in virulent racism, white supremacy, white terror domination that I've ever experienced. I already have Geronimo G. Jago Pratt book, and I'm ready to go. Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo G. Jago Pratt. Johnny Cochran takes center stage in that one as well. And in fact, oh my, I wasn't going to read from Johnny Cochran's book today because we got to hear a nice, healthy chunk from his closing argument. But he does mention, I told you he has Geronimo Pratt's picture in his book, Journey to Justice, and he mentions him repeatedly, even when he gets to the O.J. Simpson section, and he gets to the verdict, and he's like, we won. He said, I'm going to do this exact same walk. We're going to go through this exact same procedure with Geronimo Pratt. That because this book came out, I think, a year or two before Geronimo Pratt was released in 1997. But there's no other book for us to read next. Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt, and the timing, Black Panther Party, the Fred Hampton movie, which is disgraceful, but that's something else. But Geronimo Pratt, they might make a movie about him before, you know, we're all done. That'll be on Netflix. I'll read one more. Let's see. All right. Female victim of racism. Do we need to thank deviant Jeffrey Toobin for indirectly recommending this book and helping to exonerate O.J. Simpson in the eyes of a few confused non-white people? Perhaps not. Yeah, because if he had kept his pants up, we wouldn't have been reading this book. Pants up, don't zoom. I have not finished watching the trial online, although I did try to skip ahead to catch up with the Cows Book Club. This was not possible as Toobin left out so much material, and it would have meant skipping key parts of the trial, such as Mark Furman's second cross-examination, which I have still not got to. I said he left out a lot of material. I intend to finish watching the trial and want to give full reverence to Johnny Cochran's closing argument, so I decided not to rush too far ahead. Good investment. Jeff Toobin failed to mention Marsha Clark's attempt at faking being moved to tears when arguing that the defense team should not introduce the Furman tapes. She even got biblical by using the metaphor of King Solomon, the two wives, and the baby, comparing this to Judge Ito's consideration of whether or not to introduce the tapes. I don't think anyone in the courtroom was moved by her poor acting. Toobin also failed to mention Mark Furman's mistreatment of non-white male with a white mother. He harassed her over a number of years. Furman was accused of forcing him to strip naked and bend over after he was arrested. The man not ye. Furman then commented that all niggers look alike. The prosecution tried to block the non-white male from testifying to his mistreatment. Nicole Simpson's family confuses me. Certainly no one deserves to die in the horrific way she or Ronald Goldman did. I am puzzled, however, by the testimony that O.J. Simpson abused Nicole over many years in front of her family, yet they were on his payroll. I could not imagine accepting money from someone who was abusing my child or sibling. Many folks have said that, and that recital video that Mr. Cochran talked about in his closing argument that Jeffrey Toobin totally omitted from his book, I would not. I don't care how much money you have. If you have been beating on my sibling or someone in my family, you've done this in my presence, bruised them up to the point they had to call the police. If you were doing that first time, last time, do you think I'm going to be kissing on you out in public? Oh, so good to see you. Come in. Let me give you some sugar. You are outside of your mind. That individual would be persona non grata every day. I mean, at minimum, it was of OJ. First time, last time. But I mean, it would be real obvious. Like, we are not cool. Anyway, as I continue to watch the trial, it gets harder and harder to have sympathy for Christopher Darden, victim. But I have to wonder about his mental health, given the level of attention and criticism he was receiving. I do think it was very shrewd of him not to question Mark Furman. I believe his life would have been even more difficult following the trial if he had been the lawyer seen to be directly defending Furman's integrity. Patterns in the system of white supremacy were mentioned on recent broadcasts. One thing is clear from the trial that the white people involved, lawyers on either side as well as witnesses, assume all white people think black people are niggers and are used to using the term or being in the company of people who do. I have found this book reading both compelling and educational for a number of reasons. I have a clear understanding of how injustices are perpetrated towards non-white people through the criminal justice system and the mechanics of how trials are carried out, which is fascinating and clearly ripe for manipulation by unscrupulous lawyers, etc. As has been stated by others, it takes many people looking the other way or participating to ensure a non-white person is wrongly convicted of a crime. Dedication. If being wrongly accused of murder could happen to someone like O.J. Simpson, it could happen to any non-white person. Geronimo Pratt, for example. This case leads me to question the accusations made against others more closely, including Bill Cosby. He mentioned him last week on the book study. They were making rumors that he was paying for OJ's defense. And Michael Jackson, who Johnny Cochran represented before this case and afterwards. I have no idea whether they are guilty, but I'm certainly more curious about the validity of the claims made against them. The Michael Jackson case was with the exact same L.A. prosecuting attorney's office. Some of the same attorneys, in fact, Bill Hodgman, were involved in that case the first time around. Because of the lives that are ruined, those wrongly accused of a crime and the victims and their families whose interests are ultimately not served if further injustices are carried out in their names. I guess in a system of injustice, they are all collateral damage. And finally, again, I highlight the fact that the prosecution was initially seeking the death penalty for O.J. Simpson, a point that should not be forgotten and is sobering. How many other non-white people have gone through this with not so successful an outcome? Geronimo Pratt was in greater confinement for 27 years before, he didn't do this. And we knew all along, but he was a no-count nigger, and we thought he needed to be in trouble for something. 27 years. And they knew he didn't do this. Much obliged, ma'am. The email is untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll get other folks who dialed in as well. *61 if you have thoughts, observations to share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed. Maybe folks are getting their thoughts together. We'll give them a moment to get their notes, collect their thoughts. Other folks who wrote in, make sure I get all the emails. Victim of racism, male, black male. I've been following the Jeffrey Toobin reading, but I've been reluctant to comment because for weeks I've struggled with understanding OJ's innocence. I was attending elementary school in New York during the trial, and I had no idea who O.J. Simpson was at the time. When he was found not guilty the following year, I assumed the jury was right, and I didn't give it much thought thereafter. My mind changed, however, when I moved to L.A. in 2014. I was new to the area and my job, so my coworkers took it upon themselves to inform me of L.A.'s recent history. One day, a non-white coworker who classified herself as Latina, could be a white person, declared, "You know OJ was guilty, right?" I didn't care either way, but she proceeded to say that she studied the evidence and described how brutal the murder was. I was even given a tour of the Brentwood area where OJ and Michael Jackson lived. Two criminals, two peas in a pod. I remember still unconvinced, but I didn't argue about it and continued to listen. What changed my mind were the ESPN documentary, which is total white supremacy propaganda. It is documentary in name only. And the people, the O.J. Simpson. And again, what did I say last week? One thing I have learned in reading this book, I have learned a lot about master deception. Some of the things that you do for master deception, you lie and you just keep repeating your lie for as long as possible. You write a book so that the lie can outlive you when you die. People will have your book at the library. You help create new sources to concretize your lie. Jeffrey Toobin is right in the middle of the ESPN documentary spewing all of his filth and nonsense. He did it, Rental James, and he didn't put the glove on and all this. And Jeffrey Toobin is a consultant and is the basis for the TV show, The Run of His Life. And they even dramatize his character in the middle of it. So he gets to compound all of his lies. And Johnny Cochran called Chris Darden a nigger and all the rest of it. You lie. You lie forever, as long as possible. And then you help create other sources. So now when people look at this case, the experts and the definitive. Matter of fact, I got to make sure I read that. He did an interview, Jeffrey Toobin, and I'll make sure I read that before we exit. But now you get people are influenced not by the trial, not by the actual evidence. You get all these biased sources that are hugely promoted. That ESPN documentary won all kinds of awards. And, oh, this is smashing. It's great. Same thing with the FX series, Cuba Gooding Jr. It's smashing. It's great. And all of it, bias, flagrantly contradicts things that were presented in the trial. They just get the flat out lie. That's all it is. And oh yeah, he did it and convinced millions, and particularly said this last week, younger people who were maybe either not alive at the time of the trial or they were in elementary school. They were young children when this happened, so they weren't paying attention to this. I don't know who O.J. Simpson is. Like, well, I don't really care either way if he did it or not. Got other more important things on my time, and it's recess coming. And so they just get what? They get these type of nonsense, racist propaganda narratives, and then other potential racists, this Latina, you know he did it right. You know he did it right. You know he did. Nobody capes for O.J. Simpson. Continuing. So to sum it up, they seem to imply that O.J. Simpson might possibly be a sociopath, not Mark Furman. I knew nothing about O.J. Simpson with the recent violence of prominent football players. I figured maybe O.J. had undergone some kind of CTE rage and murdered his wife and her friend. O.J. did say he thinks he does have CTE. He's commented about that online, and how could he not? Having followed the reading and done my own research, I'm right back to where I started. OJ is not guilty. I'm also passively listening to the trial and noticing details that are never highlighted. One example is that the limo driver doesn't see the white Bronco on the way into OJ's mansion, but he doesn't see it on the way out either. That's so important because we just heard a lie from Jeffrey Toobin where he said, "I just knew Alan Park convicted O.J. Simpson because he said he didn't see the Bronco on his way there, and he was fairly certain he didn't see it on the way out." And he didn't testify either way. He said he left and something was obscuring his view on the right side, but he didn't know what it was. Could have been the Bronco. I don't know. Again, and the defense asked him, were you paying attention? Were you scouting and looking for vehicles? Or were you just worried about getting O.J. Simpson? I was just looking for O.J. Simpson. I was not trying to identify vehicles out on the street. Either way. It also seems that aside from football, most of the people around O.J. don't regard him as being a violent person at all. I'm still following along, and a lot of the details are fascinating. Has anyone pointed it out that Nicole Simpson's dog, the Akita, is named Cato after Cato Kalin? Yes, Mr. Toobin mentions that in the book. It's mentioned in the trial. They apparently were so enamored with cool, blonde, white, jobless, no-count Cato that they named the dog after him. Yes. But the propaganda is strong, and it will get you, particularly if you don't know, like, the factual detail of the case, which, again, you would have to watch the trial or read the transcript. He said a lot of the details came out just watching the trial. Pretty much all of the sources that are written or so-called documentaries and films and things that are out, like 99.9% of them, OJ did it. It's some manifestation of that. He killed them with his son. He killed them with a dog. He killed them with Charlie. Just whatever you can think of. OJ Simpson either did it by himself, or he ordered somebody to do it, or he's with them when they did it, or he paid somebody, like something. Orinthal James is guilty. Continuing. Other folks who dialed in, did y'all have commentary or still getting your thoughts together? While folks are still getting their thoughts together, I'll make sure we get through all of our Toobin commentary and folks for commentary from folks who've written in. Let's see. Oh, God, I thought I was getting close to the end, and we're not. So closing in, let's see. One of our investors, he wrote in. Chapter 23, Free OJ. Number one, Cochran waving of the bloody shirt of racial resentment must be judged a tactical success. Toobin sure can turn a phrase. I have no idea what this means. Number two, Marcia Clark, she had come to see these were fearful jurors, more concerned about the reaction to their verdict than about reaching the right one. Jurors, they took few notes. The prosecutors, they needed a courageous jury. They didn't have one. The statement is both inaccurate. From other sources, the jurors were apparently very attentive. And just one more example of Jeff Toobin practicing racism, white supremacy. Number three, Cochran was more miser than provocateur. What really appealed to him was the fruit of Islam guards was that they volunteered their services. Maybe he used them because he felt he could trust them. Excellent point, in my view. Again, the Million Man March happened about 13 days after the verdict in the O.J. Simpson case. So very, very close in terms of the context of what was happening. And I am sure, I mean, you want to talk about who rankles whites more? Al Sharpton, Louis Farrakhan, like, woo, close neck and neck. So that in addition, like, we're going to have to suffer through Orinthal James being acquitted and then ushered out of the courtroom jailhouse by the fruit of Islam. Oh, Minister Farrakhan smiling, going to jab us, doesn't fit, don't acquit it. Agony. Horrible autumn of 1995 for racist man and racist woman. Let's see. I'll get to a few of my thoughts while folks are, I guess, getting their final thoughts together. Or maybe folks are all tired of Orinthal James. We have our last section before we will be all done with Toobin's work from chapter 23. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Man, I mean, Gus, this is one of them books where it had to end, but I wish it was longer. You know, this was actually a great conversation, the O.J. case. I've mentioned this case several times on the show over the years. I've never faulted or he's innocent. the jury, the way they describe the jury coming to their decision. The blood evidence was totally thrown out. It was done. It was, you took blood home, you know, blood that wasn't in the area ends up there. There's missing blood from the blood you took home. All of that's done. That can't hold up in court. The jury's not even looking at that. That seemed pretty accurate to me. It's nothing. I was talking to the firefighter earlier. I said, if OJ was in the same situation as the Central Park Five, and someone, white person or anyone, but most probably a white person or a non-white, non-black person, killed OJ, said, hey, I did it. I hid the blood under this beach, under this pier. It should still be there. The blood, the knife is there. Everything is, he has details that wasn't even put out in the case. They would still not let OJ go for this. They would still make him, find a way to make him guilty for this, because that's just white supremacy. He's being guilty, I believe, because he had a white wife that was very appealing to white men. He was living the life that they wish they lived. He's a superstar athlete, and, you know, they took this opportunity to get at him. Other than that, I'll save my commentary for later. Thank you, Gus. Oh, last thing, Gus. Around this time, and this was, I think, the comment I was making earlier, I was in Jersey City, New Jersey, at college. I was going to school at Hudson County Community College, which is in the part of the city called Journal Square, which is like the main part of the city, you know, the Times Square of Jersey City, so to speak. And I'm getting out of school, and they're reading the verdict, and it's on the televisions and the electronic stores, and everyone's gathering around. And the police starts acting like we're going to riot for O.J. Simpson. And it was, you know, like, no, you know, like, it was just very odd. But they were planting that seed, like, the week before in the minds of people, just mentioning it, you know, they expect massive parts of this city is going to be shut down. And it was like they wanted us to riot. That's what I got. I'm doing my line thinking.
Toobin talked about how the LAPD was, you know, had shut areas down, and they were thinking, maybe even hoping, that there would be some rowdiness. They could go out and crack some heads. That is kind of wild that it would be that same sort of atmosphere on the other side of the country or in other parts of the country so far away from Southern California. But the L.A. riots did have a big impact in 92, and they were not just in L.A., not just in California either. So, yikes. Don't see any constructive value to rioting. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Mo in Dallas. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. This was a very, very, very enlightening, study session with this book. I haven't been able to participate in all of the sessions, but I have been following along. poor Rob Shapiro, you know. Like, he really got a raw end out of deal. And he was just depressed and talking about it. And, you know, and he lost some of his notoriety. And he really feels like he deserved, according to this book, you know, more attention, especially, you know, with all of the time and effort that he didn't put into this case. I thought that was very interesting how he was categorized as, you know, moping around and winning at the same time. You know, that was interesting. Marcia Clark trying to manufacture scenarios was just like just shameful. A lot of what she was trying to build in her head for her case just didn't make sense. And I've noticed that throughout this reading, she's giving plenty of excuses for being incompetent. You know, Tubin said she was, you know, bordering on bulimia or bulimic or having weight loss issues, and she was just ordering food and not eating it. And she had a tooth pulled. Her performance was just substandard, in my opinion. She just didn't do well, and I don't think she was. I think she was looking for an easy layup to kind of boost her career when it came to this case, and she was. She got flustered when she came. She had to, you know, plead a case against an actual legitimate defense. I feel that's just my conjecture. Cochran using the FOI, I agree with the writer. Maybe he trusted the Fruit of Islam. I don't recall, and I may have missed it, but I can't, like, off the top of my head, recall any time in his book where Jeffrey Tubin mentioned Johnny Cochran's death threats that he received, and I believe he received more death threats than O.J. Simpson. But I could be in error. He might have mentioned it. And there was one part of the reading that stuck out to me when the jury were excused from the courtroom after the verdict, and Mr. Tubin said that a black jury like pumped the black power fist. I immediately went to YouTube after hearing that, and I watched the jury leave the courtroom, and I didn't see that fist. Now, granted, I didn't see the entire jury leave, but he said that this juror had the longest walk out of the courtroom. So I assume that meant he was in the back and he pumped the black fist before he left. According to the video that I watched, the last juror that was leaving was a white man. Like, so I think that was just like if that's what he was is leading readers to believe after purchasing his book, he is just a liar and a pervert, and I don't respect him. This is a great book, though. Thank you. I mean my line.
Much obliged, Bowen Dallas, hopefully with water warmth. Called him a pervert. Well, Zoom Bomber of 2020. I mean, the record is Zoom Bomber of 2020. There shouldn't be video of the Black Power salute because the jury is supposed to be anonymous. So people shouldn't be able to see the jury exiting. That said, the juror in question is Lon Cryer. He is in the Court TV OJ 25 series. And he testifies that he did put a fist up, and this is cited in a number of different sources. So it seems Tubin might be being truthful on this one, and I guess I'm just going primarily because Mr. Cryer said he did it. But he said he put this up, and it is reported that he was formerly in the Black Panther Party, Mr. Cryer, this juror. But all of that notwithstanding, he said he did this just as a hey. Live your life, you got a second chance, you know, go forth and prosper type of a thing. All of that.
Well, with that newfound evidence, that was just based on what I found. And if I mistakenly accused Jeff Tubin of being a liar in that regard, I wanted on record that I apologize for that. He lied plenty of other times for me to call him a liar, though, so. But I just couldn't find it on YouTube.
Sure, for sure. He did lie many times in the book. Just, yeah, that one. But, yeah, it shouldn't be on you. If anybody can find that video, like, whoa, that is majorly incorrect. It shouldn't be there because the jury is supposed to be anonymous. Sorry, but it is on the final episode, episode 25. They talk to Mr. Cryer, and he explains that moment and some of the other details of the deliberation process, which is mostly close to what Tubin said, mostly. Some differences. But even with all of that, with the fist in the air thing, I just want to add, since we talked about Black and I'm Proud yesterday and all that, man, Bell Hooks, she's a victim of racism. She's in a documentary film where they mention the movie Eddie Murphy Raw. And she says that there's a part where he's talking about having promiscuous sexual intercourse with lots of black females, and the crowd is doing the black fist in the air. And she said, wow, this is stunning, like the toxic black masculinity and blah, 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 and all the rest of it. And I said, I don't think that's the Black Panther, Black Power fist in the air. I think sometimes people just put their fist in the air as a gesture. It's not Black Power. It's not Black Panther. It's just fist in the air. Right on. I think that's all it means. Like, it's not anything else. Like, I think people see that and it just get white people, non-white people, and it gets blown way out of proportion. Like a black person with a fist in the air, all of a sudden you are Huey P. Newton's cousin. You are in the Black Panther Party. You are a black identity extremist and all this other. I just put my hand up. I was trying to stretch. I was saying right on. I was saying, hey, instead of doing the wave, I just put the fist up. Hey, how you doing? All right. That's nothing else. Now all of a sudden I'm a card carrying member of the African Liberation Army. Remember that one? Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments to share, proceed.
Hello, can you be heard?
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. I appreciated listening to the verdict you read. So it made me think about being in gym. I shared this before and how we were all around the radio and everybody's like erupted in excitement and happiness because it was just something about it. Like I said, other than hearing what the adults were saying, I always felt like he was innocent. And like for me, outside of the things I've heard in the book and in the clips and everything, it really for me gave me some hope, actually, in a way, even though, you know, they continue to mess with OJ later on afterward. But it still gave me a little bit of hope because they were trying so much to set him up to go to prison for the rest of his life, that the very thing that they were trying to do didn't work. And it kind of reminded me of like something my grandmother would say. It was a metaphor, but she would say, when you dig a ditch for somebody else, she was like, take a pillow and a blanket, because that ditch is going to be for you. And that's what happened in a sense with the LAPD and the prosecution. And it's not that they had all these, you know, really bad outcomes afterwards, but the fact that they tried so much to execute, you know, this man in a way, like by putting him in prison for life, with all this false evidence, false testimony, false witnesses, it backfired, didn't work, and there was cosmic justice. And I'm very happy about that, and I just pray it would happen more often for victims of racism. But I also recognize, you know, he had the money for a great, you know, defense team and everything. But still, I've sensed the, you know, the divine working on his behalf, hearing it again and hearing about, you know, how the jury, you know, deliberated. And it was just good to hear. And I want to stand by and listen to this epilogue. But one other thing. I believe the term for the reporting in this book is called yellow journalism. There's a lot of insertion of personal emotion, unnecessary additives, and, you know, what do you call it? Anecdotes that just weren't necessary. If you're going to report on something, no matter how you feel about the situation, you're supposed to just, in the same way of a lawyer, you're supposed to just give the facts, you know, and he doesn't do that, you know, and he, you know, it's a lot of jealousy in this situation with Jeffrey Toobin and the people, Robert Shapiro, unfortunately Chris Darden, a lot of jealousy was pervading, but it still worked out for OJ. So that was great. It was great to hear. I'll mute my line. Thanks.
Lots of jealousy in this here text. Absolutely. Other folks that we have missed, totally much obliged. Irie in Louisiana.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all of the callers. Nation of Islam, Fruit of Islam. I think somewhere around in the 80s or the 90s, they got into private security, which is relevant because as a business, because there were certain individuals who, number one, can afford the service, and also from the standpoint to whereas not trust for local law enforcement for protection. So it's definitely something that's needed. As far as I know, they have a pretty good record of being professional. Also, I have known them to active security for areas, small areas, you know, at some points in time in and around the 80s and the 90s and present. I've heard of Mr. Nasheed hiring them every now and then. What else I want to say? That was a pretty funny rendition of "The Lion Sleeps Tonight." I never heard that version before. The cliche that the attorney was famous for, that cliche stayed popular for decades. It's still somewhat of a cliche that people will recognize even today. Although some younger people may not know exactly where it comes from, but if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit was very, very popular, a popular cliche that people would rattle off, even for something that is relevant to what they were talking about or just saying it. I would say just about anybody would say, even people who are not non-white, racially classified as black, would state that they wouldn't mind having Mr. Cochran as their attorney. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Doesn't fit, must acquit. One of the most well-known phrases from the trial, even all these years later. Let's see. I will do my notes quickly, and then we'll get to the epilogue. Let's see. Tubin. He says he starts off talking about the reception that Johnny Cochran gets at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium for the annual Soul Train Lady of Soul Awards. And incidentally, when I heard that, I was reminded of Mr. Fuller, where he says we have more like nonsense, worthless award ceremonies. Like there is nothing to celebrate in the system of white supremacy. And just the whole, I feel like this is Jeffrey Toobin on the sly, like the Soul Train Lady of Soul Awards. Like, no disrespect to Don Cornelius, cowbell, but that's right up there with James Brown, Black and I'm Proud. Anyway, he says the leading figures of African-American community, all of the leading figures of black people are white. Next, Johnny Cochran got the Lena Horde Award, cowbell. He encouraged the National Association of Black Journalists to take on the forces of this country examining racism. I just thought that was interesting because I just read about the National Association of Black Journalists and Black reporters talking about racism today in the L.A. Times. No, yes, which was front and center for the O.J. Simpson case. Cerise Castle, she was just talking about racism that she experienced in journalism. Just reading about that today in the paper. Let's see. Tubin says it's difficult to determine the precision, to determine with precision what impact Cochran's speech has had on the jury. The jury was sequestered. Again, they had no television. They had no phone. When they got phone privileges, they were one-way monitored. So unless they couldn't just read the newspaper, the newspapers were edited, censored. They would take out any stories or mentions of the O.J. Simpson case. So they could not just go and read, get on their phone, get on their laptop and see, oh, Johnny Cochran was in South Carolina today. No. So unless he thinks some of these jury members had family members who were calling on the limited times that they could make phone calls to give them an updated itinerary of where Mr. Cochran was going to be speaking and what he talked about in an age where there wasn't Wi-Fi everywhere. Come on, Jeff Tubin. Liar. All of this about the black jury members being fearful. I want to stop and pause right there before we get into black jury members being fearful. This jury is not all black. There are two white women and a non-white, non-black male on this jury. Are these two white women, are they fearful of going back to the white community with a not guilty verdict? Did they feel any pressure about showing their face amongst their family members and white friends that they didn't stick out and at least get a mistrial, that they threw in the towel, so to speak, and just went along, fine, let's acquit O.J. Simpson. I love USC football. They weren't, it was just the niggers on the jury who were under pressure. And again, do we have any examples? Has that ever happened where black jury members either convicted a black person or exonerated a white person incorrectly or whatever? Has that ever happened where the black jury members came back and black people targeted them, talked bad about them, beat them up, threw trash on their lawn, keyed their car? When has that happened? I thought white people did a pretty good job of keeping black people off the jury in most cases. Next, he says... let's see. The prosecution had many reasons to feel doomed, not just the Furman tapes, the inept investigation and lying police officers, not just Mark Furman. Let's see. I don't know about all this police groveling before celebrities. They have not presented me any testimony of police groveling in front of O.J. Simpson, like not one shred of someone being starstruck. You can't tell me that Van Natter and Lang and Furman were starstruck, whatever that means, just enamored with O.J. Simpson when they're lying about the search warrant and lying about hopping over the fence and lying about the blood that they found. You can't tell me that that's, oh, we just are so in love. We're just starstruck by O.J. So get out of here. Let's see. He says that Officer Bushy looked just like Daryl Gates and described Daryl Gates as the most hated man in black Los Angeles. Again, how do you know this? Did you take a poll? I know this is really close to the Rodney King, but why not Officer Stacey Coon? Lots of people to pick from. Why not Susan Smith? That had just happened. She just blamed a black guy wearing a knit cap like O.J. Simpson for killing her children. Why not her? Let's see. Yeah, I think we had the call or person who wrote in last week who talked about how this book and the FX series does so much to kind of rehabilitate Marcia Clark and portray her as a a heroine and a victim herself of sexism and toxic masculinity, and she was working so hard against so many forces, and a single mom and going through a divorce and leaking these nude photographs of her and all of the patriarchy that she had to experience, and now she's got an eating disorder. Remember, she said she had, like, I think it was like $60,000 in dental bills because of her bulimia eating disorder. Now it's all dental pain. I've got to go and get my teeth. I can't even finish out the closing argument, and I'm just beaten down at that. Not just you had lying, racist enforcement officials and lame evidence, and you had a case you should have lost. Not just that. I mean, oh, she's so tired. Oh, can we empathize with my kid? Out of here. Let's see. Oh, and then the juror, she said she had come to see that these were fearful jurors, more concerned about the reaction to their verdict than about reaching the right one. Are you serious? Where is the evidence of that, that the jury was, and again, none of the white jury members felt this pressure that, oh man, if I don't stick it out, if I don't do something, I'm going to be in so much trouble when I get back to the white community. That's not here at all. It's just black people who felt that pressure. Let's see. Oh, in the notes, Lon Cryer, in addition to explaining the Black Power salute or whatever you want to call it, he put his fist in the air, that Black Power. Jeffrey Toobin says, in one passage, Marsha Clark drew on the vast changes the trial had wrought in her own life. She thought the jurors might wonder just what Simpson had been doing in the narrow passageway behind Kalen's room. Never proved that he was there. The place where he knocked into the air conditioner and dropped the glove. You are thinking, why not drop it in the dumpster on the way home? This is total nonsense. Why not dispose of it when he disposed of the knife that you never find? And the rest of the bloody clothes that you never find? Anyway, she says, talking about the jury, that they did not even take notes, saying that they took few notes. That is an absolute lie. It's like visually contradicted. When they interview Lon Cryer for Court TV, they say he took over 600 pages of notes. Not 100, over 600 pages of notes. He had a satchel with all of these legal pads, and he just started pulling them out and pulling them out. Now, it could have been just for effect. It was on TV. It could have been all props. However, they had several scenes of him reading notes from the trial about specific testimony and things that stood out. The Fiato brothers, when they testified at the end, it is a total lie that they didn't take any. And this is the same fellow who did the fist in the air, 600 pages of notes. You're a liar, Jeff Toobin. Let's see. All of this about the dumpster is nonsense. If he could find time to throw away the knife and bloody clothes, he could have dropped all the gloves there, right? Make up your mind. Which one is it? Let's see. Either he was in a rage or he planned all this out. Which one is it? Pick one. Let's see. He does all this stopping and making time for Marsha Clark, her bulimia and divorce and childcare problems, which he even concedes seems like it's a lie that she was just using that to get more time to work. He doesn't do that for Chris Darden. Chris Darden is just an inept, incompetent coon. It's not, oh, his brother was dying from AIDS in the middle of all this. He gives one short little sentence way back when, and then we're off. Christopher Darden is just lame and incompetent for the rest of the book. Marsha Clark is sharp and beautiful and intelligent and just beaten down by these patriarchal males and no child care and tooth medical problems and divorce issues and her nicotine addiction and all that. Like, get out of here. This is a trifling white woman with a no-count case she should have lost. Let's see. Uncouth white woman, just what I said last week. Crass white woman. Let's see. Anything else? We can get to the epilogue. Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I just said. Exactly. He talked about Phil Vanetta. This is the white police officer. Johnny Cochran's closing argument, as he said, he had a big board and it had Vanetta's big lies. Clown, and I've never seen anything like this in court. But it was so long. It was so many of them. Them lying on the search warrant. They lied about jumping over the wall. They lied and said that they had confirmed it was blood on the Bronco on the morning after the murders, which they had not confirmed. They didn't know what it was. He says, Tubin says that all of this, Vanatter's big lies and calling the Furman and Vanetta the twins of deception and the twin demons of deception. He said this, of course, was monstrously unfair to Vanetta, whose errors stemmed more from laziness than malevolence. So you're telling me someone who lies on a search warrant and says that O.J. Simpson went to Chicago unexpectedly, that's laziness instead of malevolence. You're telling me someone, in fact, a group of someones, including Mark Furman, lied on a search warrant and said, oh, we neglected to include that we hopped a fence at a gated property with no search warrant. We just leave that out. That's laziness, not malevolence. I could go on, but it's a whole lot. Why is that laziness and not, at minimum, it's a little suspicious. You're a liar, Def Tubin. Stop caping for racist enforcement officers and lying enforcement officers. It'd be different if it was just one, but you got a big list here of Vanetta's lies. Let's see. The violations of attorney client privilege with Shapiro recording conversations, and then Jeffrey Tubin is making it seem as though he's getting private memos from the defense team where they're talking about who can speak to the press and whatnot. Like, it's been from the beginning of the book to the end. The people that O.J. Simpson is paying for his defense are not even adhering to the ethics of being a defense prosecutor. Attorney client privilege. Johnny Cochran pointed that out. Beginning to end, he wrote about that in his book. Like, what kind of violations are these? Like, you could be looked at and getting disbarred for this sort of thing. Let's see, anything else? He says that the rules by the sheriffs to make the jury members have their bags packed and ready every day to go to court so that they could leave abruptly. In my opinion, the jury would not have needed any signals to be quick about this. They had been sequestered for about 10 months at this point. Not that you don't have a television, you don't have a phone, you don't have Wi-Fi, you don't have a laptop, you can't be around your friends, you can't go anywhere. You are under armed guard by a lot of white people all day long. And they take your key at night. You can't even be trusted to have your room key. They come around and collect it. I don't think they would need a reminder. Let's hurry up and get all of this done with. In fact, you can have sexual intercourse once a week. I don't think anybody here would need a reminder. Let's hurry up and get this done. Anything else I need to say? We can get to the epilogue. It's disputed whether or not Simpson knew in advance. Johnny Cochran said he did not know in advance. Mr. Simpson didn't know in advance. F. Lee Bailey said that there was some heads up, that there was some of the sheriffs were asking for autographs and that sort of thing. So it would at least seem it's contested if it's as flagrant as Tubin writes here, that everybody just knew the night before. Foregone conclusion. We're going to win. But we'll get to the epilogue. Emmett Till, man, pay attention. We will wrap things up. Jeffrey Tubin, the run of his life, the people versus O.J. Simpson. We will hear from Toni Morrison after this is all done. The last word from O.J. Simpson, but we will hear from the grandsister, Toni Morrison. We talked about her book, The Birth of a Nationhood, last week, which is all about the O.J. Simpson trial. Charlie Flippin' Rose, and look how vicious our full circle is. The only reason we're reading this book is because Jeffrey Tubin masturbating on his Zoom call. Charlie Rose interviewed lots of folks from the O.J. Simpson experience, trial and all. Charlie Rose now under those same allegations of sexual misconduct and all of that. Some folks, this is more recent. These accusations have surfaced, but all the way through with the white people and their perverted sexual activities through and through with this text. But we will hear from Toni Morrison and some of the co-authors of that book, Birth of a Nationhood. She had a lot of interesting things to say. We read a little snippet of it last week. That'll come after the epilogue is done. Jeffrey Toobin, The Final Word, The Run of His Life, Context of White Supremacy.
Epilogue. Now I can tell you. Larry Schiller, literary entrepreneur, had laid careful plans to cash in quickly on an acquittal. Within an hour of the verdict, Simpson was driven in a white van from downtown to his home in Brentwood. He was accompanied by Robert Kardashian, Schiller, and Schiller's camera. Schiller and his girlfriend, Kathy Ammerman, had both worked as photographers over the years, and Schiller knew that exclusive photographs of the victory party would command a hefty price. In the weeks before the verdict, Schiller arranged to sell first rights to the photos to the supermarket tabloid Star for a six-figure sum. Simpson and Schiller split the proceeds, and the photographs bore the copyright marks of both of their companies, Orenthal Productions and Polaris Communications. The verdict came on a Tuesday, which was the Star's weekly deadline, but the resourceful Schiller had made contingency plans so the pictures could make it into the next issue. While the jury was deliberating, Schiller had converted the garage at Simpson's home into a photo-developing lab and turned the maid's room into a satellite transmission center. All during the evening after the verdict, as friends and family joined Simpson to toast his freedom, Schiller and Ammerman snapped dozens of photos, hurriedly developed them in the garage, then transmitted them to the Star from Gigi Guarin's old quarters. The following morning, Schiller sent a CD-ROM full of party photographs on a plane to Germany. The Schiller-Simpson joint venture had sold those for an additional fee to the weekly Stern. It was a rather quiet celebration at Rockingham that evening. The small, dedicated group who had stood by Simpson throughout the long trial all paid their respects. There was his family, of course, presided over by his mother and two sisters, as well as his older children, Jason and Arnell. A.C. Cowlings was there, as was Skip Taft, Simpson's business manager. Most striking were the absences. The golfing buddies, Nicole's friends, the dozens of pals who used to attend Simpson's annual 4th of July bash at the house. They had all chosen the other side in this case. Those guests who did come gathered around a piano and sang hymns. Simpson mostly stayed in his bedroom, receiving guests in small groups. Only one person stayed by Simpson's side the entire evening. That was Peter Burt, a reporter for The Star, whose presence was part of Schiller's deal with the magazine. After the party, it was Schiller who did not leave Simpson's side. With his camera at the ready, Schiller followed O.J. for the next several days, documenting his life for the resale market. On October 6th, 3 days after the verdict, Schiller's literary agent, Ike Williams, faxed a letter to book publishers offering a sequel to I Want to Tell You. Williams said this next book, to be entitled Now I Can Tell You, would be O.J. Simpson's first-person account of the trial from his arrest to the not guilty verdict and his reunion with his family. Like the first book, this one would be organized and edited by Larry Schiller, but there would be an additional bonus. The Schiller-Simpson joint venture was also offering Schiller's original and unique photographs of Simpson's reunion with Sidney and Justin Simpson, which took place on October 4th. However, these literary ventures paled in comparison to the top priority of Simpson's financial team in the wake of the verdict. All through the summer of 1995, Skip Taft and Larry King had engaged in detailed negotiations about a pay-per-view special following the verdict. The two-hour program was to feature King interviewing Simpson live, as well as phone calls from viewers. It was to take place whether Simpson was acquitted or convicted, but not if the trial ended in a hung jury. Turner Broadcasting, the parent company of Cable News Network, would buy the rights from Simpson for $25 million. In lieu of a fee for himself, King would arrange for about $1 million of the money to go to his favorite charity, the Cardiac Foundation. Simpson would receive about $4 million personally. According to King and Taft's arrangement, the balance of the money, more than $15 million after expenses, would go to establish a network of O.J. Simpson boys' clubs in cities across America. The photographs of the victory party ran as scheduled in the Star and Stern, but none of the other schemes came to fruition. There has been no sequel to I Want to Tell You. As soon as word leaked out to the public that Larry King was even considering participating in a pay-per-view interview with Simpson, executives at CNN's parent company announced that no such project would take place. Simpson's prospects for any pay-per-view appearance vanished completely when cable system operators across the country said they would refuse to distribute any broadcast that would enrich the former defendant. The darkly comic notion of O.J. Simpson boys' clubs never materialized. All of these projects fell victim to the enormous backlash against the verdict in mainstream, that is, white, America. Because of television, the announcement of the verdict became a nationally shared experience, one on par, incredibly, with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. In the days immediately after the end of the case in court, televised images of the verdict itself yielded to images of people watching the verdict. The pictures revealed many scenes of African Americans cheering the verdict, from college campuses to battered women's shelters. White viewers, by contrast, watched in stunned, generally appalled silence. Reaction to the verdict was promptly replaced by reaction to the reaction, and then reaction to that reaction, and so on. Which is to say, as Henry Louis Gates Jr. observed, black indignation at white anger, at black jubilation, at Simpson's acquittal. The passing months did not so much heal the wounds in race relations as witness the growth of an ugly scar. Assessing the meaning of the Simpson case became, and remains, a cottage industry. But in evaluating that legacy, it is useful, even necessary, to return to the underlying events, that is, to what happened outside Nicole Brown Simpson's condominium on the night of June 12, 1994. The Simpson case was never some free-floating set of ideas, ripe for any number of equally valid interpretations. The case emerged from a set of facts, and those facts matter. As to the central fact in the case, it is my view that Simpson murdered his ex-wife and her friend on June 12th. Any rational analysis of the events and the evidence in question leads to that conclusion. This is true whether one considers evidence not presented to the jury, such as the results of Simpson's polygraph examination and his flight with Al Cowlings on June 17th, or just the evidence established in court. Notwithstanding the prosecution's many errors, the evidence against Simpson at the trial was overwhelming. Simpson had a violent relationship with his ex-wife, and tensions between them were growing in the weeks leading up to the murders. Simpson had no alibi for the time of the murders, nor was his Bronco parked at his home during that time. Simpson had a cut on his left hand on the day after the murders, and DNA tests showed conclusively that it was Simpson's blood to the left of the shoe prints leaving the scene. Nicole's blood was found on a sock in his bedroom, and Goldman's blood, as well as Simpson's, was found in the Bronco. Hair consistent with Simpson's was found on the killer's cap and on Goldman's shirt. The gloves that Nicole bought for Simpson in 1990 were almost certainly the ones used by her killer. It is theoretically possible, of course, that Simpson killed the two victims and that the police also planted evidence against him. that he was guilty and framed. But I am convinced that did not happen, and that it could not have happened. In their summations, Cochran and Scheck suggested that the police, in their effort to frame Simpson, planted at least the following items. 1. Simpson's blood on the rear gate at Bundy. 2. Goldman's blood in Simpson's Bronco. 3. Nicole's blood on the sock found in his bedroom. 4. Simpson's blood on the same sock. And 5. The infamous glove at Rockingham, which had, as Clark put it in her summation, all of the evidence on it. Ron Goldman's fibers from his shirt, Ron Goldman's hair, Nicole's hair, the defendant's blood, Ron Goldman's blood, Nicole's blood, and the Bronco fiber. The defense never spelled out how all this nefarious activity took place, but pulling it off would have required more or less the following. The core of the defense case was, of course, that Furman surreptitiously took that glove from the murder scene to the defendant's home. Not only would he have had to transport the glove with its residue of the crime scene, but he would also have had to find some of Simpson's blood, from sources unknown, to deposit upon it, and then wipe the glove on the inside of Simpson's locked car, by means unknown, all the while not knowing whether Simpson had an ironclad alibi for the time of the murders. To me, this possibility is simply not believable, even taking into consideration Furman's repugnant racial views. The other police conspirators, conspicuously unnamed by the defense, would have had to be equally adept and even more determined. Many of the police officers at the crime scene noticed the blood on the back gate at Bundy. Someone would have had to wipe that off and apply Simpson's. The autopsies, where blood samples were taken from the victims, were not performed until June 14th, more than a full day after the murders. Someone would have had to take some of Goldman's blood and put it in the Bronco, which was then in police custody. And someone, the same person, another, would have had to take some of Nicole's blood and dab it on the sock, which was then in a police evidence lab. When Van Atter took his notorious trip to Brentwood with the blood vial, he only had Simpson's sample, not Nicole's, with him. All of these illegal actions by the police would have had to take place at a time when everyone involved in the case was under the most relentless media scrutiny in American legal history, and all for the benefit of an unknown killer who, like only 9% of the population, happened to share Simpson's shoe size, 12. In their comments after the trial, the jurors gamely tried to defend their verdict, insisting that it was based on the evidence, not mere racial solidarity. Brenda Moran and Yolanda Crawford believed that the glove demonstration doomed the government's case. In plain English, the glove didn't fit, Moran said. Gina Roseborough said, I believed from the beginning that he was innocent, and the course of the trial confirmed her view. Sheila Woods decried the sloppy lab procedures of the LAPD. Lon Cryer was concerned about evidence contamination and rejected Alan Park's testimony because he was mistaken about the number of cars in the driveway. As for why he gave Simpson a raised fist salute at the end of the trial, Cryer said, It was like a right on to you, Mr. Simpson. Get on with your life. Get your kids. Be happy. Get some closure in your life. The three jurors who wrote a joint book about the case, Armanda Cooley, Carrie Bess, and Marsha Rubin Jackson, attributed the decision to a combination of these factors. Anise Aschenbach, the white juror who initially voted for a conviction, asserted with some sadness that she might have fought on if she had felt any possibility of support from her colleagues. In any event, Aschenbach was deeply troubled by the testimony of Mark Furman and the evidence of his racial views. All the black jurors denied that race played any role at all in their deliberations or their decision. To me, this is implausible. The perfunctory review of 9 months' worth of evidence, the focus on tangential, if not actually irrelevant, parts of that evidence, the simply incorrect view of other evidence, and the constant focus on racial issues both inside and outside the courtroom, all these factors lead me to conclude that race played a far larger role in the verdict than the jurors conceded. As Carrie Bess indicated in her unguarded words after the verdict, they were protecting their own. This is not especially unusual. For better or worse, American jurors have a long and still flourishing tradition of both taking race into account and making their decisions, and denying that they are doing any such thing. The 10 whites, one Asian and one Latino in Simi Valley, who in 1992 acquitted the LAPD officers in the Rodney King case, denied that race factored into their decisions. So did the 10 black and two white jurors who in 1990 acquitted Washington Mayor Marion Barry of all but one of the 14 narcotics charges against him. In 1955, the two white men charged with murdering Emmett Till were acquitted by an all-white Mississippi jury after about an hour of deliberations. A spokesman for the jurors attributed their decision to the belief that there had been no identification of the dead body as that of Emmett Till. Nor is this phenomenon limited to celebrated cases. In the borough of the Bronx in New York City, where juries are more than 80% black and Hispanic, black defendants are acquitted in felony cases 47.6% of the time, which is about three times the national acquittal rate of 17% for defendants of all races. In these cases, among these jurors, race mattered. And so it was with the Simpson jurors, too. That race continues to count for so much with African-American jurors should come as no great surprise. Racism in law enforcement has persisted through many decades of American life, and black citizens, and thus black jurors, have stored too many insults for too long. The police in general, and the LAPD in particular, reap what they sow. But the genuine grievances that have led to a tradition of black hostility, to officialdom, have in turn fostered a mode of conspiratorial thinking that outstrips reality. An Emory University study of 1,000 black churchgoers in five major cities in 1990 found that more than a third believed that HIV was a form of genocide propagated by white scientists, a theory shared by 40% of African-American college students in Washington, D.C. Understanding the roots of these beliefs should not mean endorsing them. To do so is merely patronizing, a condescending pat on the head to those incapable of recognizing reality. Better, rather, to hold everyone to the same standards, and better, likewise, to speak the truth. Whites didn't concoct HIV. And O.J. Simpson wasn't innocent. The backlash against both the jury and Simpson himself was accelerated by Robert Shapiro, who, as was his custom, put his interests ahead of his clients in the immediate aftermath of the verdict. Shapiro left the courthouse on October 3rd and traveled to an ABC studio, where he gave a long-promised interview to Barbara Walters. In their conversation, an obviously bitter and angry Shapiro said of the defense effort in the case, "Not only did we play the race card, we dealt it from the bottom of the deck." He remarked further that henceforth, he would neither speak to Bailey nor work with Cochran. Shapiro's remark about the race card was featured prominently in the following day's news stories about the verdict. Shapiro's conduct was shameful on several levels. His disgust about the race card was, first, intellectually dishonest, because it was Shapiro himself who had constructed Simpson's race-based courtroom and media defense in the first place. Second, his statement helped cement the public impression that his client was acquitted because of the juror's racial sympathies, not because of his innocence, thus virtually guaranteeing that Simpson would have no chance to reestablish anything like his normal life. In my view, Shapiro's analysis of the case was more or less correct, but Simpson had a right to expect that his own lawyer would not portray the case, in substance, as the story of a murderer who got away with it. Finally, Shapiro trivialized the work of his colleagues Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, who had constructed a serious forensic and non-racial defense in the case. None of this mattered more to Shapiro than the opportunity to re-ingratiate himself in the West Los Angeles world that meant everything to him. After the Walters interview, Shapiro called his old friend Larry Feldman, the lawyer who had defended him in Mark Furman's libel suit. Shapiro boasted that he had just told Walters that the defense team had played the race card from the bottom of the deck. "You're kidding," an appalled Feldman told him. "No, really," said Shapiro, who then broke into self-satisfied laughter. Notwithstanding the fame, and in some instances fortune that the case brought them, most of the major participants now regard their experience with considerable bitterness. The most bizarre postscript to the case concerns F. Lee Bailey. In 1994, Shapiro and Bailey shared another client besides O.J. Simpson, Claude Dubock, one of the biggest marijuana dealers in the world. As part of a plea bargain in northern Florida, arranged the month before the murders on Bundy Drive, Dubock agreed to turn over virtually all of his assets to the United States government. Among them were shares in a Canadian company called Biochem Pharma, worth about $6 million at the time of the plea bargain. Also at that time, Dubock believed those shares were likely to appreciate greatly in value. So the prosecutors agreed that Bailey would hold on to the stock for the months until Dubock was formally sentenced. 2 years later, after the verdict in the Simpson case, the value of Dubock's stock had risen by more than $20 million. And Bailey told the prosecutors in Florida that he believed the appreciated portion of the stock assets belonged to him, not the federal government. The deal was never put in writing, so the judge held a hearing in February 1996 to determine the terms of the stock arrangements. The lead witness for the government was Robert Shapiro. He testified that he understood the agreement to hold that the United States, not Bailey, was entitled to the appreciated portion of the stock assets. When Bailey did not produce the stock certificates or the equivalent in cash, the judge threw the 62-year-old lawyer in jail. Bailey served 44 days in the federal detention center in Tallahassee. He was released on April 19th, only after pledging virtually all of his assets in collateral. However, after a month of living with this nearly impossible financial bind, Bailey gave up his claim to the stock. This financial imbroglio, of course, only intensified the enmity between Shapiro and Bailey. Bailey rages with little prompting at what he regards as Shapiro's betrayal. The cooler Shapiro merely notes that he plans never again to speak with Bailey. He has told friends with a smile, however, that he paid his own way to Florida to testify against Bailey. Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld returned to New York after the Simpson trial. They found that their celebrity from the case had not translated into financial support for their innocence project, which uses DNA testing to free wrongfully convicted prisoners. When they mentioned to Shapiro the possibility of a Los Angeles fundraiser for the project, he told them glumly, and probably accurately, "No Jew will give you a dime in this town." The two New Yorkers have also developed the informal specialty of vetting the books on the case written by members of Simpson's defense team. In early 1996, they reacted with shock to a draft of Shapiro's volume, The Search for Justice, for it repeatedly violated the attorney-client privilege by quoting conversations with Simpson without his consent. When they passed along their concerns to the author, Shapiro didn't change the substance of the book, but he did add Scheck and Neufeld to the list of former colleagues with whom he no longer speaks. Alone among the defense lawyers, Johnny Cochran thrives. The week after the verdict, Cochran appeared as a national spokesman on civil rights on Meet the Press, and in subsequent months, he traveled the nation and the world giving speeches. His legal practice is booming, He is completing a book that is more an autobiography than an account of the Simpson trial. The working title comes from a phrase he used in his summation to describe the Simpson trial: Journey to Justice. Lance Ito conducted his next criminal trial the week after the Simpson case ended. He has never commented publicly on the verdict, but friends report that he knows the Simpson trial did not enhance his reputation. His second most noteworthy trial had a sour postscript as well. On April 4, 1996, a federal judge in Los Angeles overturned the state conviction of financier Charles Keating on the ground that Ito had erroneously instructed the jury. After the verdict, Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden both took leaves of absence from the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. Neither is expected to return. Darden wrote a successful book on the trial and will shortly begin a new job as a professor at the Southwestern University School of Law in Los Angeles. He will teach courtroom skills. His brother Michael died of AIDS on November 29, 1995. Clark's career plans are uncertain. Since the trial, she has given a series of speeches around the United States and Canada, and has worked on her own book, for which she received an advance of more than $4 million. It is believed to be the third largest advance in the history of nonfiction publishing, surpassed only by those received by Colin Powell and H. Norman Schwarzkopf. On November 12, 1995, her father left a message on Marcia's answering machine that her 95-year-old grandfather, Pinchas Klex, had died in Israel. She did not return the call. O.J. Simpson still lives at 360 North Rockingham in Brentwood. Every other weekend he sees his children, Sydney and Justin, who reside with Nicole's parents, but he has not sought primary custody of them. He spends much of his time preparing for the civil suit filed against him by Nicole's and Goldman's heirs, a case that is expected to go to trial in the fall of 1996. His principal commercial venture since the trial, a two-hour videotaped interview with him about the murders, was a commercial failure. At $19.95 each, it sold fewer than 40,000 copies, netting Simpson about $100,000. His contracts with Hertz and NBC were not renewed. He plays golf occasionally, but never at his former home course, the Riviera Country Club. Though he was never formally evicted from the club, members of its governing board informed Skip Taft that Simpson was no longer welcome there. Simpson sees few of his friends from before the murders, but he does socialize with several of the sheriff's deputies who guarded him in jail. Simpson tells them he remains confident that, in time, he will be able to resume his former career of being O.J.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, written by Jeffrey Toobin, performed by Stephen Bell Davies.
Generally speaking, it seems to me that this case has become the narrative for the post-civil rights period, in which structures of black insufficiency and white supremacy are being put forth again as they were after Reconstruction with a film called Birth of a Nation, so that the questions are focused on what enormous media attention has to do with the way we understand our lives, other people's lives, justice, what's available to us. And it seemed to me that this became not merely a commercial story or an interesting story, but a cultural narrative, a story about this country.
And for you, it's not a flattering story about this country.
No, it seems to me that it is impossible to move into a very dangerous arena which would loom very large before us if we seriously considered the possibility of Mr. Simpson not being guilty. It is safer to believe that he is. Because the consequences of an alternate narrative are lethal.
What? I don't understand what that means. An alternate narrative is that, Mr. Simpson...
The alternate narrative would include... Now, this is just my opinion. Has nothing to do with these other contributors. The alternate narrative would assume that police mendacity is familiar and common. It would assume that tampering with evidence is routine. It would not cut Mr. Furman out of the picture as an isolated aberration. He would be very, very closely involved with all of the information about this case. His cutout, his erasure, has left us without the balance. If we think that he is important to the case, then we have to consider what is going on with the men who defend us, the men and women in the police forces, what they are defending, what they are upholding, and perhaps they are representative of chaos rather than protection from it.
You want people, Tony, to come out of this book with a further understanding of what? Why we were so obsessed, or...
I want them not to be happy with the answer that, yes, there is a difference between the way we understand race. That's not a good enough answer. It's not an answer. I want them to understand that race plays many, many roles. It is based and redistributed in the culture based on fundamental kinds of stereotype. If you have a problem, just for purposes of hypothetical examination, of motive and opportunity and some other things that may have been involved in the case, it is possible to believe all sorts of things about the alleged perpetrator if he is black. He is associated already with violence. Is associated already
by profession or by the fact that there are the allegations of beating of what?
Blackness and criminality are merged in the minds of most white Americans. The reason Time magazine altered the photograph was not to make a more beautiful cover. It was to make the association of blackness and criminality. It was to assert it as already in the materials, not as interpretation, but already there, already the story was already being manufactured, and the insistence on that relationship between criminality and black men was seeped into everything. All of the language in the movie they made, what before the trial, all of it, so that it was a narrative of black pathology, particularly of men, as well as look what happens when we, meaning the white gaze, permits a nice one to move into these other circles. You never know. It's as though he sort of fell back into blackness and criminality. And therefore, all of the judgments were already there, implanted in our minds because we are consistently presented with these modern, but nevertheless stable, images and assumptions about black men.
These are the stereotypes that have been put in American culture since before Birth of a Nation, but never more strongly than through the movies, through television, through the media. I mean, I think that's the connection you were making with Birth of a Nationhood in the title, that American media conspires, or rather it contrives, to demonize black Americans, not simply black men, but specifically in this case. And that's something that people need to understand about our media, that it's not, especially what we think of as our news media. News media today is propaganda. There's been very little objectivity in the reporting of this case. Even most media people, most newscasters, have had the audacity, the temerity to project their opinions and their dissatisfaction with, or their satisfaction with various verdicts. This is unprecedented, I think, in the way the media has behaved. Mm-hmm. But it happens because, can I say it frankly, because white people think they're allowed to place judgment upon black people. And that's what this case has brought to the surface.
When you have objective news saying, I'm happy. We always knew it. I mean, it's just amazing.
It's
just I never
Katie
heard
Kirk on NBC,
like
even in fact, she even suggested to the second jurors, aren't you happy? Outrageous for a reporter or a commentator or a newsreader to say such a thing. Aren't you happy? I mean, Jesus, it's outrageous.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. And one, I want to thank you a lot, because so many of my friends have told me that you've been fair in hosting your show and bringing the points of view from both sides. I want to thank Mr. Calhoun for taking the time out of his life. I know it had to be tough for him. And most of all, I want to thank that man, Mr. Johnny Cochran, for believing from the beginning, listening, and putting his heart and soul on the line to send me home and spend time that I'm spending right now with my kids. As I say all of this, you know, I've been watching your show, and I don't really have a lot to say now. Pretty soon I have enough to say to everybody and hopefully answer everyone's questions. But one of your callers, a lady, called a minute ago, and she asked a question about a shadowy figure running down the driveway and across the lawn and into the front door. Let me say, that was, to me, that's one of the problems. One of the problems I'm having today with people who followed this trial, they have not listened to the evidence. Marcia Clark said a person ran across the driveway. Marcia Clark has said that all along. That is not what Alan Park said. Alan Park said 15 feet roughly from my front door, which was me walking out of my front door, dropping my bags and going back in. He marked it. They put a display up, put an X. She asked him, put an X where you saw this person. 15 feet, never on the driveway, never coming down the driveway, never crossing a driveway. That is the testimony. And throughout this case, it's been this misrepresentation time and time again. People come home from work and they hear the pundits elaborating on these misrepresentations. Listen to what the witness says. Listen to what their testimony is and not what Marcia Clark told you.
That has
been the big problem. Fortunately for me, the jury listened to what the witnesses said and not Marcia Clark's or Darden's or anyone else's rendition of what they said. So, Miss, I didn't get your name. There was no shadowy figure coming down the driveway and going across the driveway. That's what Marcia Clark told you. That's not what Alan Park told you.
OJ, would you describe yourself as relieved, angry, what?
A little bit of everything. I think my basic anger, and this is the last thing I'm going to say before I leave, my basic anger is these misconceptions. My basic anger is people I've heard said I followed the case. I've heard experts say, this was the testimony today, and that wasn't the testimony today. There were so many times I went back to my cell and I watched TV. I go to my attorney room. I talk to my attorneys and some witnesses, and we say, were these experts looking at the same or hearing? Are they in the same courtroom that we were in today? Did they hear the testimony today? Because what they were reporting on the news, what they were reporting on these various shows was not what the witnesses were saying. And once again, that lady will call in. Look at the testimony. Marcia Clark told you that. Alan Park did not tell you that.
A couple quick things.
I got to go.
What was it like with the kids today?
It's been great. It's been great.
Thank you.
I appreciate how fair you've been.
Thank you.
God bless you, OJ.
I guess from that, thanks, OJ, he will be making a statement. I gather he's going to come forward in some forum.
I think he will be.
Soon. His voice sounded very strong.
Oh, yes. He has resolved. Nobody, none of the lawyers even, knew the facts as well as O.J. Simpson, as you just could tell. He knew the facts chapter and verse. He thought it was his life, and he knew those facts. He made sure we knew those facts. And
so, doesn't sound too crazy about Marcia.
Oh, I think he respects her, but he would always tell me how he felt they would twist the facts. And he's very right about that. There was a mark. This person was, I said, was only seen within 10 to 15 feet of the door going in. And he knows those facts.
Context of white supremacy. Whew. We are all done. Feel like I should take a bow. My goodness. I guess we had a lot of folks who said, you know, they felt like they learned something. Even though this is in the midst of the Rona and seems like it's lots of wacky things happening in the world besides this goofy trial from a quarter century ago. But wowee, lots to learn about the system of white supremacy. And if anything, this book section is pretty layered, meaning you have the text that we read and then the inclusion of lots of other text to kind of round out the sources and to combat some of Tubin's deception. We heard Toni Morrison speaking with Charlie Rose from 1997, and as I said, that's a collection of the authors for the book Birth of a Nationhood. You also heard from black male author, co-author Armand White. He was also talking about the bias of many of the journalists who covered this trial. He has one of the essays in that book, Birth of a Nationhood. And then at the end, we heard Johnny Cochran, O.J. Simpson, their dialogue with the late Larry King, who just passed away a couple weeks ago as we were reading this book. As I said, I'll just include the quick report from The Ringer, and then we'll get any folks who dialed in if you have commentary or a final word before we wrap up on Jeff Toobin's work. We'll get your comments. The report from The Ringer, this is before all the Zoom activity. There's a Q&A, and they ask, you're on TV just about every day at this point. Don't you get recognized on the street? He says, you know, it's funny. The culture of New York City, where I live most of the time, is that people almost never say anything, but it happens all the time elsewhere. I'm big in airports, but it's very strange. I spend most of my time in New York, and the number of times people say something to me on the street is really very small. Yet as soon as I leave, it starts happening all the time. It's very interesting. When people approach you, is it because they recognize you from CNN, or do you get more specific responses to the stories you've worked on? For a long time, people would say to me, oh, you're the OJ guy. But that hasn't been true for a number of years. People have moved on. I think I'm recognized as the guy who talks about law on TV, the guy who can't keep his pants up on Zoom. For years, an older African-American woman worked at the polling station near my home. And every time I would go to vote, she would look at me and she would say, you know, you were unfair to OJ. We had lots of use of the word fair in this section. And she would say it every election day. It was interesting because it was just sort of funny, but she was also the perfect demographic for believing in OJ's innocence. All the surveys and research on both sides said older African-American women were most sympathetic to OJ, and she completely bore that out. Toobin wrote about the prosecution's research on this subject in a 1996 story in The New Yorker. Long after anyone else was talking about it, this woman still had an axe to grind. She's an axe murderer, too, just like that old stab in a rental James. Let's see if folks have commentary to get in. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61. If you would like to participate, if you think you have a comment to share, don't wait till the last moment. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, final thoughts, proceed. Nothing stood out, folks thinking, nothing stood out. Grant, I'll get to my notes from the epilogue. Let's see. That's not the epilogue. Oh, here we go. All right, epilogue. The Emmett Till is the main portion, but we'll see. Make sure I'm not missing anything. Let's see. Oh, okay, yeah. So he says, OJ is guilty, duh. And he said, this is true whether one considers evidence not presented to the jury, such as the results of Simpson's polygraph examination. That is not admissible, and F. Lee Bailey talked about that. Shouldn't have even been administered. He was in an emotional state after the death of his wife. And Shapiro had said he was just trying to do it quickly because he thought he was going to be arrested soon, so just trying to get the information as can. But that's, come on now. Next, he says, his flight with Al Cowlings on June 17, which I thought was one of the most stunning portions in the book. It was just last week. He said that the prosecution didn't include evidence about the Bronco chase, so-called, because they weren't sure he was actually trying to flee. I was stunned. Like, I've heard for years, for a quarter century, people say, oh, he did it. If he didn't do it, why did he try to escape? And you're telling me that the prosecutors, they weren't even sure that he was actually trying to escape? Like, maybe he actually was going to commit suicide? Like, are you kidding me, Jeff Toobin? Come on. Next, he says, overwhelming evidence, that word used a lot too. Violent relationship with his ex-wife, totally leaving out that he had changed his prenuptial agreement. Financial incentive not to be violent with his wife. Tension growing between them in the weeks leading up. I didn't see any evidence of that at all. Like, where is that? Like, that they had a brawl, an argument at the recital video? Is there evidence of tension between them that was growing? Come on, Tube. Let's see. His Bronco not being parked there that night. Again, Allen Park, you know, you have to take whatever you will from that in terms of whether the Bronco was there or if it moved and all of that. Let's see. The blood on the gate, I think he doesn't really deal too much with the blood evidence and the way that the defense picked this apart. It's certainly not in depth the way that you will get in trial. It shouldn't be that you have blood on the back gate not collected for weeks after the murder trial. He keeps emphasizing why or how with the LAPD and the forensic scientists, how would they be planting or doing all these misdeeds when they've got, you know, the media right there and the crushing every day of the paparazzi and all that? Knowing you're going to be heavily scrutinized, it would be a work to make sure that we cross every T, dot every I. That didn't happen at all. How is it in a murder case, a double murder case no less, where you wait weeks before you collect blood evidence? Come on. Let's see. The blood in the Bronco. He says that the Bronco was locked. I don't know if it was locked or not. I didn't hear testimony from O.J. Simpson that, oh yeah, the Bronco was definitely locked. Alarm on it and everything. And even still, are you telling me that enforcement officers, they don't have the means themselves or resources to get into a locked vehicle? Next. Let's see. And he says all the black jurors denied that race played any role in their deliberations or their decision. This was not an all-black jury. Did the white jurors say that race played no role? Did the non-white, non-black male say that race played no role? Why is it only focused on the black jurors and whether or not they're being truthful when they say, really, it should be racism? He says race played no role. I don't know why it's just focused on these black jurors. It was not an all-black jury. The Emmett Till murder trial, that was an all-white jury where, yes, they practiced racism. This wasn't an all-black jury. You had white jury members who easily could have said, hey, we are in here for Team White. We are going to hang this jury. We don't need you to change your vote. All of you niggers can, you know, cape for O.J. Simpson all you want to and have non-black people voting guilty. And we're just going to hang out and be non-guilty. And that'll be that. And we'll have a hung jury and they can do this all again with a new jury or whatever. It'll just be, I don't know about the non-white, non-black male who has given interviews and said, we got it right. I thought he was not guilty then, not guilty now, reasonable doubt. They did not prove their case. I've heard him give interviews where he said the same thing. So I guess it could have been, well, we're going to hold it down for Team White. It'll be 2-10. And that's just the way it'll go. That didn't. In fact, they couldn't even hang out for a day. Hours, he said, literally, we're done. Let's go ahead. Not guilty. No focus at all to what in the world? You all couldn't even hang in for a day and insist you waffled in a matter of minutes, literally? Come on, Tube. Even his lame comparison to Emmett Till, I just feel like this is one of the tackiest moments to say that these jurors lied in saying that race was a factor, and then to say, talking about Marion Barry being acquitted, and then to say in 1955, the two white men charged with murdering Emmett Till were acquitted by an all-white Mississippi jury after about an hour of deliberations. A spokesman for the jurors attributed their decision to the belief that there had been no identification of the dead body as that of Emmett Till. clearly false. This is not the O.J. Simpson case. Remember I talk about metaphors? There is no way on your worst day where you really can't use logic. You might be half drunk, half unconscious. There is no way you can compare what happened with the Emmett Till murder trial to the trial of O.J. Simpson. Like, no way at all. You did not have two black jury members on the Emmett Till trial saying we're going to hang in there. We're going to try and see if we can. And then they walk. No, not comparable at all. They couldn't even have a Mark Furman in the Emmett Till trial. Well, you know, we don't know. We got the cop might have planted some evidence. You know, I'm not really sure. Nah, you don't have that at all. Jeffrey Toobin, you're just lame. You're a liar. I suspect you're a racist and you're a pervert. You should have been fired. Glad now the world can maybe look at you a little more closely. And then you participated in all that propaganda and racism with the ESPN so-called documentary and the FX series to spread more of your lies and propaganda. He says that race, not racism, race continues to count for so much with African-American jurors should come as no great surprise. There are Supreme Court cases about prosecutors keeping black people off of juries. We do not have a plague in this country of black jurists who refuse to convict the O.J. Simpsons of the world. We do, it seems, have a problem, a system-wide problem of deliberately excluding black jurors. This trial, I said that at the beginning, this trial is even used as a part of that. In the state of California, they can ask a black juror, potential juror, do you agree with the O.J. Simpson criminal trial verdict of 1995? And if they answer yes, they can be booted. They don't even use this for jurors in general. Like, they didn't say that we can just ask anybody. Like, we have a white woman, a white man, a Latinx female, a transgender, a multiracial person. No. They said just potential black jurors. We asked them, do you agree with the O.J. Simpson verdict in 1995? You do? Oh, yeah. Get on out of here. Get on out. Like, what in the world? Incidentally, I'm serious. This book is super light. People said that they enjoyed it and learned a lot. If for me, that means you can read a book that is poor, that is not a great book, and still learn a lot and find it enjoyable, because this is not a great book. He lies every... I've been thinking that the whole time. Like, shouldn't this book qualify? Like, it should be right up there with Nutricide. Worst books ever. You can't be a good book if you lie every page. And he's lying on Johnny Cochran and all these folks in the book. Like, no footnotes to have a white man who's being deceptive, and you don't have footnotes listed in your text to cite where you're getting this information from. Like, it's got to be one of the lamest books we've ever read. Like, it should be challenging Isabel Wilkerson at minimum for second worst book ever. Enjoyed it. We've learned a lot. I've enjoyed studying. I'll put it that way. I've enjoyed studying the O.J. Simpson trial and picking apart the deception and racism in Toobin's book. But yes, this would have to be one of the worst books I've read just on the deception factor. A white person writing a book that is rife with deception, man, that's write a review. That should be high on the list of indictments to confuse people for generations about a case that has generated so much attention. Sure, I get my last one in. An Emory University study of 1,000 black churchgoers in five major cities in 1990 found that more than a third believed that HIV was a form of genocide propagated by white scientists, a theory shared by 40% of African-American college students in Washington, D.C. Understanding the roots of these beliefs should not mean endorsing them. To do so is merely patronizing, a condescending pat on the head to those incapable of recognizing reality. He mentions HIV/AIDS a few times in this book, talking about the enforcement officers. Why would they plant a bloody glove? They could catch AIDS. You have video of these officers traipsing through a bloody crime scene with no personal protective equipment, no gloves. They didn't seem concerned about catching the AIDS virus at that time. But regardless, Bill Cosby and his wife, before his arrest, they thought HIV/AIDS could have been a so-called government conspiracy and said so publicly. We talked about all this years before the Rona and Ebola, because as they've said it every day now, the long history of Tuskegee and Nurse Rivers and all of that, of course, black people have some suspicions about all of this. But this is another one that just seems like a really condescending way of Jeffrey Toobin to talk down about black people as being dumb and stupid and have a lot of dumb, frivolous conspiracy theories like 5G is producing the Rona. And that type of thing. I feel like he did this throughout the book. It couldn't even be that you could have legitimate reasons for a exoneration in this case. In my view, it should just be, isn't that O.J. Simpson the case where you had a police officer commit perjury in the middle of the trial? Oh, yeah, I understand why he was exonerated. Like, it would be nothing else to talk about. I can't imagine having a case where a police officer commits perjury and not just a periphery officer, but someone who was right there at the crime scene finding pertinent evidence, and he commits perjury, and specifically perjury about, did you manufacture any evidence? And you can't even answer the question? That should be enough right there, much less then you start looking at the rest of it and lies and incompetence and the timeline doesn't work out and we don't even have a time of death. You don't have a murder knife. You don't have these bloody clothes. You don't have a witness. Where is the mountain of evidence again? The overwhelming mountain of evidence. Where is it at again? You don't even know if the Bronco chase was him trying to escape, even though everyone has said that definitively for 25 years. You don't. In fact, one of the questions in the book I left out, one of the questions was, if OJ is so guilty, why didn't you play the 30 minutes of him talking to Van Atter and Lang the day after the murders? He's such a sociopath. He's such a narcissist. You got the recording. Why don't you play it for the jury? We can hear him trying to be conniving and him going back and forth and making up excuses. Why didn't you just play the tape for the jury? You wasted our time with Cato Kalin and all these other lame witnesses. Why not? Let's just hear from O.J. Simpson. Any other comments folks want to get in? Or we all done with Rental James?
Hello, Maddie Hillis.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Let me start by saying I do believe, too, that there's some conspiracy of sorts with so-called AIDS, HIV, but, you know, that's sidebar. I remember hearing one night Yvette Carnell saying, I'm trying to quote her directly, the most consequential thing in your life is the creation of race. And I think that can be paraphrased with the creation of racism. And I bring that up because the defense wasn't playing the race card. You know, they were basically using what they had been given, which was, you know, a bunch of evidence that racist people were trying to wrongfully convict O.J. Simpson of murder. And that's all it was. And the people that they decided to try to pursue this defeat with, you know, they admitted racist of sorts. They may not have come out and say, yes, I'm racist. But, I mean, when you come out and say you want to, you know, murder people and maim them, and that you have maimed them, and then you have people, like you said, they don't know who, what, when, where, why, or how, miraculously, but somehow, some way, they absolutely know that O.J. did it. That's indications of racism. Here's the other thing I was going to say. You know, it's great. That was crazy. Crazy. And then the thing about, there goes Emmett Till. You cannot compare, no one should compare, I should say, the case of what happened with that verdict to this one, because they're two different things. But let's flip it, right? If he does want to make that comparison, then by way of it, he's saying that the jury got it wrong in both cases, and he doesn't even realize that's what he's saying. So if he's saying that the jury got it wrong, not convicting O.J. Simpson, but then they also got it wrong, not convicting the racist that killed Emmett Till. Like, in effect, tell me if I got it mixed up, but if that's a comparison he's trying to make about juries getting it wrong based on race or whatever, that's what I got from it. And I'll meet my line, and it was a good series. Thank you very much for enduring through this. High five. Black power, sis. Amandla.
The black power fist. Uh-oh. I think that's what he's trying to convey, that, yeah, juries get it wrong and going off being racist, that black juries can be racist and get it wrong. White juries can be racist and get it wrong. Yeah, I think that's what he's trying to convey, which doesn't get any better than tacky Jeff Toobin. Pants up, don't zoom. Other folks, comments to share?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Yes, I was just thinking about the white collective's warped understanding or philosophy of correctness when it comes to non-white people. And it's a long history of it. I was just looking at Jack Johnson today, and based on him winning the heavyweight championship, white people were so angry that they went out and started killing black people as a reaction to that. When they see that non-white people, especially non-white black people, are in favor of something different from their understanding, they show their anger. I mean, times have changed over the years since Jack Johnson, to whereas the system of racist white supremacy is even a lot more secure than it was back 100 years ago. So they really don't have to do what they did with black people during Jack Johnson's time. But nevertheless, they show their anger and disappointment, and even to the standpoint of identifying non-white black people as quote-unquote racist for making different decisions than what they make on something. And it's always interesting, like this particular trial, to observe that. I can recall in 1980 where a black male was beaten to death by law enforcement. And a lot of white people were angry about the decision that was made. Well, actually, it was the O.J. Simpson trial that really where they were angry about the decision that was made. And they, I can recall that all during maybe about a week or so, they basically displayed their anger. If you were a non-white person and engaged in conversation, which I avoided, engaged in conversation with white people about it, they would display their anger about a non-white person having a different opinion than theirs. And it's something that is traditional, especially in this part of the world.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Are there any folks that we missed totally who had commentary to add?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus. This series, firstly, let me just say this, sir. This series has been very informative, very good for me. Just in understanding OJ's innocence overall, and his importance, just the importance of even the case's overall significance, and just like the history of this country and the credulity of the criminal justice system. And Johnny Cochran's just overall genius, quite honestly. Marsha Clark as a white woman in the space, and the effect she has on the space as just a physical being is interesting, thinking about all of the physical alterations that she kind of manifested to try to charge that space, and her positioning and posturing, kind of testing all of the non-white males in the space, who were not given maybe the adoration that the white woman kind of requires or calls for. And I would say that any kind of correlation to the Emmett Till case I might see in the Marsha Clark, Carolyn Bryant kind of connection. And then Tubin, lastly, I think his self-righteousness is interesting, and just how there was something in the epilogue about how he was stating that it's so obvious Simpson's guilt, except for he didn't explicitly call out Furman by name, and the absence of the tapes and, you know, the perjury, et cetera. I wasn't sure about adding Darden's brother's death in the epilogue, what that was doing. I'm not sure. Maybe that was a sympathetic move or some type of dig. It was interesting. And then lastly, just big up to Toni Morrison for referencing anti-black misandry on Charlie Rose. That was dope. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
The grandsister, Toni Morrison. As I said, I feel like, you know, Jeffrey Toobin, he spent quite a bit of time, and even more so in the FX series, with, you know, sympathy for Marsha Clark and what she was going through, and trying to be a working mom, and dealing with, as I said, the sexist barbs from males and fellow coworkers and all the rest of it. But that's not there at all for Christopher Darden, like sympathy and, oh man, and what his brother's going through. And he's wearing an AIDS ribbon at the conclusion of the trial and all the rest of it. That just gets real short shrift, and back to these no count, lame, incompetent black people, racist black people. Other folks who had commentary they wanted to share. Did we miss anyone?
One more.
Go ahead.
Yes. Sad to see OJ go. Man, you have to prove motive in this type of situation. Murder one, you have to prove motive. Why did he kill his ex-wife? He was just spotted at a recital with, seemingly unangered or anything by her. That was supposed to be proven. They failed to prove that. The prosecution tried to deflect from having no motive to using evidence of domestic violence years earlier. Classic attempt white supremacists use on black people is to make you guilty in public opinion when they can't prove you guilty in real life. We've seen them do that the last few years to several black men. No proof of intent. They couldn't prove the timeline. If you can't prove the timeline and the intent isn't there, no murder weapon, no knife, nothing to tie him to those murders that was definitive or beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the prosecution's job to do. And they failed to do the job. The blood evidence was proven to be tainted. One of the lead officers takes blood home with them. And blood was missing from the blood he turned in. The lead investigative detective was practicing white supremacy. He refused to testify on the stand about planting evidence, as you just pointed out, Gus. That makes the cop's testimony non and void. If he's lying, and they're all lying, they're all covering for him. It's just common sense. They showed a picture of a fence with no blood one day, and days later, the same fence had blood there. That just happened to be OJ's, you know, the cop that had already taken the blood home, and there was preservation, preservatives in the chemicals inside the blood, which totally throws the blood evidence out. So right now they have no case. OJ's trial was a conspiracy between the LAPD, the Los Angeles District Attorney, and the judge to put this innocent black man in jail, and to cover up for the misconduct in the investigation and the collection of the evidence. Everything about this was wrong, and it was all a total big cover-up. And the conspiracy continued afterwards with the dishonesty in the media for the last 30 years, or however long it's been. Total dishonesty, people like Jeff Toobin, who no one would recognize in New York because he's not big enough. He's a writer for the New Yorker. You know, he's not on Fox News. He's not on CNN. All the media's here. The New Yorker is barely insignificant. Marsha Clark was the worst prosecutor ever. Presented the worst case I've ever seen. Robert Shapiro was the worst trial lawyer ever. Robert Shapiro was more concerned about his image and status in white society after the trial than he was about getting OJ off. He would have been happy just cutting the deal. Ambulance chaser. Marsha Clark did extremely well for herself after this. She should have been called out for all her terrible prosecution tactics. Everything she did failed, but instead she lands herself a huge book deal, several TV show appearances, even in movies. With the IMC, whatever, when you look at people's names and actors, her list is about as long as Cicely Tyson's. I'm being a little sarcastic here. Robert Shapiro went on to use his name and fame to land more high-paying clients after this trial. Everyone won, even though they lost. But OJ ends up being guilty for the rest of his life, going to jail for trying to get back stuff people stole from him. This is just how the system of white supremacy works. I think this case is a perfect example of our problem. Even if you are as successful, high profile, dress right, speak right, do everything white people say black people need to do so that they don't face racism, you still end up a victim of white supremacy in the worst way. I mean, if OJ had an all-white jury, OJ would have been guilty, even with all this missed evidence, because that's how the system works. That part you said about the Bronx. The Bronx has 45% black people, 45% non-white Spanish-speaking people. That's 90% right there. Of course, their juries are going to be mostly non-white people. And I think they look at the evidence, and without that white that those white jurors there swaying them, they make very good decisions. I don't think they're letting people off in the Bronx because they're black or because, you know, they're looking at the evidence and they're not being swayed by all the tactics that the white supremacists use. And I'll meet my mind. Thank you, Gus.
I live way far away from New York. Thank goodness. I'm not a fan of cold weather or New York living, but I do not think black people in New York City or anywhere else are just going to be letting criminals, killers, roam scot-free just because they feel, well, Whitey has abused us, so we'll let Marvin the Butcher off this time. Don't you kill it. I mean, come on. Come on. The caller at 5049. If you have commentary, line should be open.
Oh man, hi everyone. I was just thinking, the Alan Park testimony, I think that's the limousine driver, he doesn't mention the hearing the Bronco at all. And Broncos are pretty loud vehicles, and you would have probably heard a Bronco pull up to the driveway and the door slam if OJ had pulled up. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
That Mr. F. Lee Bailey, when he was a guest on the program, talked about that. Johnny Cochran talks about that in his book, in the loudness of those vehicles. I think they're manufactured to be loud, and saying the exact thing, that neighborhood, it was a Sunday night, it's after 10 o'clock, not too much traffic. he probably would have heard the Bronco, much less the headlights. He probably would have heard and or seen it. In fact, F. Lee Bailey said they did experiments like, let's even say Navy, like with the Frogman movie, let's say that Navy SEAL trained Orenthal James Simpson, he's just hacked up these white people, and so he slips the car into neutral to drift to the curb, right? So let's say he did that. Even that, it would make enough noise, it would be heard. You would still, as was stated, you'd have to open the door and get out and all the rest of it. If it's a quiet Sunday night, even a drifting Bronco would be heard, if not seen, out on the street. It's a white SUV we're talking about. So, yeah, all of that information. There's nobody I could really point to in terms of the prosecution's case. Was like, yeah, this damning testimony from. There's no one. None of the abuse witnesses, none of the police officers. Just so we can tighten our game up, Mark Furman was not the lead detective on this case. The lead detectives were Phil Van Natter. That's the one Johnny Cochran had the board up. Van Natter's Big Lies and Tom Lang. Those were the lead detectives on this case. Mark Furman was not the lead detective. He was the first detective on the scene. And then he was replaced with Lang and Van Natter, and they all went to the house and everything to find the gun. But he was not the lead detective. Language thing. But yeah, there's no the major testimony and witnesses from the case in terms of for the prosecution. Like, they had major problems. Cato Caitlin, Mark Furman, Van Natter, Dennis Fung. The court, they didn't even call the coroner. They had to call a replacement, Dr. Lakshmanan. I mean, there's lots and lots of problems with the prosecution's witnesses. They don't have a case. It should not be an indictment of black jury members that they were too dumb and ignorant to convict O.J. Simpson. It should just be, hey, the prosecution did not have a case, in addition to a police officer committing perjury in the middle of the case. Like, there were lots of even if I think he did it, that's the way at minimum it should be stated. Even if I think he did it, there are lots of logical, reasonable reasons to explain why a jury would acquit. Do we have any other comments on the book, what we heard before we wrap up? Are folks good?
Have you heard?
Mo in Dallas, yes, sir.
A couple of things. The conjecture about black people and AIDS, it implies that, I agree with the other callers. It implies that black people are like inherently is ignorant when it comes to healthcare, just like the conjecture when it comes to black people in court cases, which implies that we're inherently criminal, which is untrue. Like, and I hate to use this phrase, but we're, like, especially in jury settings, I believe that black jurors are more fair. I hate using that phrase, but, you know, because, like, they do believe, or they, for the most part, they do try to follow the rules that are assigned to the jury because they don't want to be accused of being unfair. And it's just like when it doesn't work out in favor of whatever white supremacy has set up, then they get accused of, or they get persecuted themselves. And you get to imply just all of these odd negative things. It was a very, very, very enlightening book, and I enjoyed the study session. I think that's all I have. I'm in my life.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. That word fair in the word. I've talked about that word a lot this week, too. Did we miss anyone? We got everybody.
The Gus, the very last thing I was going to say, and I might have said this before, the Ford Motor Company bought out the Bronco again. It's coming out this year. It's the number one pre-ordered car in the world right now. And the number one color, that's been pre-ordered is white. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Orenthal James, I think there were rumblings that that was going to happen sometime around the June 12th date last summer, which some folks thought to be in poor taste and not a coincidence. But tacky, keep it tacky. We will be here. Johnny Cochran, continue. There are lots of OJ books. I've said the whole time, like, man, if you are, you know, still itching to get more details and you want to learn about the civil trial, that's a whole nother affair, a new cast of attorneys, new judge and all that. What happened with the 2007 trial and conviction, if you want to keep going through. Lots more information. You can get F. Lee Bailey's book that's supposed to be coming out this year, and Johnny Cochran's book, Christopher Darden's book. I read quite a bit from that. Marsha Clark. I mean, it's a lot. Alan Dershowitz has a book about all this. Robert Shapiro, Madam Foreman, the book by the three O.J. Simpson jurists, three of the black female jury members. There's lots of literature on this case. If you would like to read more, get more details, you can have a robust Simpson library. But we will be sticking with Johnny Cochran, Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. Book that I actually have read already, thoroughly enjoyed, has lots of information about the Black Panther Party within, lots of footnotes, something this book didn't have, footnotes. Man, I'm excited, looking forward, and right on time with all the hubbub about Fred Hampton Jr. and the speaking of lame films about moments in black history, the current project on Fred Hampton. But that is another program. Anywho, we'll be here tomorrow neutralizing workplace racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what has gone down the last few days. Let's see, making sure I didn't miss one of our investors. He wrote in, get all of his commentary from Now I Can Tell You the Epilogue. He writes, number one, in early 1997, Cochran virtually abandoned his law practice to become co-host of a nightly program on Court TV. Cochran's career as a whole faces an uncertain future. Shortly after the OJ trial, Johnny Cochran and the Cochran Law Firm filed a class action lawsuit for 18,000 plaintiffs in Anniston, Alabama, against Monsanto Corporation and others in an environmental racism lawsuit. $300 million was eventually awarded to the plaintiffs. Harriet Washington discussed this in the book club reading, A Terrible Thing to Waste. I was like, oh, we talked about that. In fact, that was exactly at this moment last year. We were reading A Terrible Thing to Waste, and I believe she starts the book talking about that case. That's why I said the legend of Johnny Cochran, like so much of his work was about addressing racism. Final thoughts. Number one, I was at work when the verdict was read and learned about it from the radio. I vividly remember the expression of deep pain and disgust on the face of a white woman co-worker shortly after the verdict was made public. I found her response both amusing and confusing at the time. I questioned myself. Why does she care so much about this? Great question. At the time, I thought OJ was guilty, me too, but felt his defense made an excellent case for reasonable doubt. I think I understand now a little better why she had such a visceral reaction. Number two, there was so much wrong with this case, and I have taken a lot of notes from the readings and your supporting segments. If you were discussing this case with someone, what do you think are the top three things that support OJ's innocence? Ooh, three things. I'd say no murder weapon. That's a big one, even for the prosecution's case. The timeline. Really, so much of this is the time. It's almost more important than the murder weapon. If, I mean, nobody has a time nailed down for this, so we're just guessing based on, you know, circumstantial evidence. If we're going off of the preponderance of witness testimony and when did we hear the dog bark and the hey, 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 and all the rest of it, if we're going off all of that, it would seem like somewhere in the neighborhood of 10:30 to 10:40 is when this happened. But again, that's just a guess. The prosecution says 10-15. There's no evidence to support that except that one guy. I'm going to discount that. So if we take the preponderance, we're saying 10-30 to 10-40, somewhere in that range. Anybody, do you think that's reasonable to kill two able-bodied adults with just a knife by yourself? Because that's the prosecution's theory. He didn't do this. He didn't have a helper. He didn't have a crew. Just the rental James. So do you think one 45, 46-year-old person with a football career, so you're not going to be super nimble and quick, 46-year-old person can kill two able-bodied adults, one of them 20 years younger than you and fit? You can do that and then get back to your residence in 15 minutes and not be bloodied, cut up, bruised, all the rest of it? That should at least, let me pause at least and really draw this out. If you think that that's possible, pause and write it out how you would do that. Marsha Clark has that in the book. How would you do that? How would you do that? Do you get that from the Frogman training? So that would be one. The timeline, two, you don't have a murder weapon. As I said, where's the knife? The bloody clothes? Where's all that at? And then three, oof, it's a lot to pick from number three. I mean, my God, you got Mark Furman and all of that. Let's see. What would I take for number three? I might take his police testimony. I mean, it's a lot of other, you know, goofy things around all of this. I might take his police testimony when they question, or the interrogation, the interview from Monday, June 13, the day after the murders. They didn't even present that at trial. That was Johnny Cochran. That was one of his questions. You think he's guilty? Why didn't you present that? You know, if you think he's lying to them and giving them 50 different answers about how he cut his finger and, you know, he sounds like a guilty person and like he's just trying to pull one over, why didn't you play it? I listened to that video. I was stunned. Some of the, like I said, because he's saying things in there that will make just like, huh. He's saying, I got all my guns at the house. Go check them. I'll hand them over right now. I got guns at the where. They're registered. They're legal. Check them out. Now, again, it could be that this is a slick coon killer. He stabbed up these white people and he's just trying to throw us off. I got my guns at the house. They haven't been there. That could be. Or it could be, no, I didn't do this. I don't even know how they were killed. I'm guessing, thinking they were shot or something. Tell him to check out that tape, because people say, you know, he was lying. He sounded like a criminal. He sounded like a guilty person. Listen to that tape. Come to your own. And keep in mind when you listen to it, because it's on YouTube, this wasn't presented to the jury. The prosecution had access to this. If OJ was guilty and they thought, hey, you hear it, you're hearing a guilty man talk to the cops, and he volunteers his blood at the end of all this, that would be my three. No knife, volunteers his blood and everything for all this at the interview, or just the interview, where he volunteers his blood. No knife for all of this. Those would be my three things that I think you could submit that, yeah, he did not in the goofy timeline, he did not commit these crimes. You could probably pick a bunch, though, because of Mark Furman, you could just say that's lots of things that you could submit that this is goofy. Anyway, in conclusion, I'm firmly in the camp that OJ is innocent. Me too. I could be wrong. I'm still learning. I wasn't there. But at least based on what I got here from the Jeff Toobins of the world, no way. Not even possible. That said, much obliged for folks tuning in. Hoping we did major overtime. Like, man, I got lost track of the clock. Freaking OJ. That's what I felt all these years. That was one reason right there. Like, man, people spend all this time talking about OJ Simpson like it's nothing else happening in the world. We got vaccines and Rona and everything else going on. And rental James is not the most important thing. That's how I felt for a long time. Like, I felt like it was obscene the amount of time and energy that people invested in OJ Simpson. But I was confused. I did not understand racism, white supremacy, but even with all of that said, there are many other things related to racism happening, like Geronimo Pratt next week. Thanks for everyone tuning in. I'll take a bow. It seems like we did lots of work here. Still on the slave ship, so I don't know what, you know, bows or applause are worth on the that's at the Soul Train musical that I was talking about in there. It's all about the same. Anywho, we'll be here in about 24 hours. Hope it was constructive reading, more important than watching television. Sorry, OJ, I thought you were guilty all these years. My bad. I didn't even look at the trial. I didn't have any evidence. I just assumed. Everybody said you were guilty, so I assumed you were guilty. My fault. My fault. Must have quit. Must have quit. Sobriety would be best. Black people get accused of stuff all the time. It would be much better to be clear thinking, sober, so that you can make great choices as opposed to being under the influence and not really quite sure what's happening. In addition to being sober, hunker down. That would be my suggestion. If you got to go out, be very alert with regards to what's happening around you. People, if folks are being hostile and rowdy, you never know. Could be a Mark Furman. If you didn't leave your residence prepared for Mortal Kombat, exit. Get away from that person. They could be armed. They might have a whole group of Mark Furmans who are armed and they are ready to do harm. Be alert when you leave. We're sober. Driver or passenger, we're buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things to keep ourselves safe from race soldiers, badge or no. And again, we need our attention so we can be aware of what's happening. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. Simple thing right there that'll work against racism, white supremacy. Black self-respect to the highest level means not name-calling black people for any reason. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.